This week in Retronauts, Portal Wombat! Wait, I messed it up. We'll fix it in post. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Retronauts. We are here today to talk about the most important fighting game made in America in 1992, and that is Mortal Kombat. Joining me on today's very violent, almost disgusting, but also kind of silly journey, we have a regular guest from the UK.
Oh, yeah, that's me. Hello, I'm Stuart Jepp, and I once pulled someone's skull out of their head with the spine still attached, and as a result, I did time.
I'm sorry, Stu. Is that a big offense in the UK? In America, it's a misdemeanor at this point.
It's frowned upon. I didn't mean to do it. It was an accident. They snuck up on me and tapped me on the shoulder in a sort of friendly manner, and I went into reflux, and all the rest is history.
Stu, as an American, I can say, just stand your ground, okay? You had a right to defend yourself, and you had a right to pull that skull out of its head.
Yeah, bring the skull to court after.
And our special guest, special because they've never been here before, and because they've written about this game, please introduce yourself.
Yes, I am David L. Craddock, and I was excited to be here. Now I'm scared. This conversation, I didn't realize it would be so violent. If this is rated M, my mom is going to have to listen to it for me first.
Maybe we can make it so that you have to unlock the unrated one by pressing like down, up, left, left, A, right, down, or something.
Okay, that's fine. I can work with that.
Of course, Stu, you knew the code by heart. Of course you did.
It's good code.
But yes, David Craddock, thank you for joining us here. I think the first question we have to ask right off the bat is, do your friends call you DLC?
That was a later nickname, definitely. Okay. Downloadable content. The first was Mortal because of Mortal Kombat. All I did in school was talk about Mortal Kombat. My teacher, a teacher actually started that. Said, Mortal, pass your homework up. And I was like, wow, I think I talk about this maybe a little too much.
Oh, my goodness. All right. Then you are definitely in the right place on the right show for this discussion. Because, yes, in this year, don't want to date ourselves, but right now when we're recording this, it is the year 2022. And that means 30 years ago, Mortal Kombat happened. It happened. We could not have stopped it. It happened. It's past tense already. So we're going to talk about this game, this very important video game. And I think let's just start with the basics from everybody here. So what happened with you? What happened? Can you remember back to when you first saw the combat? What happened for you? When was it? Where was it? How much details can you give us? We'll start with you, Mortal, sir.
Yes, Mortal, sir. That's it. That's what I like. I was in an arcade. My parents had divorced when I was young, which was actually great because they were probably going to kill each other anyway. And I got some cool extended family out of the deal and two arcades to visit, depending on where I was. Oh. And I remember I was with my dad at our local arcade near his place. And there was a mob of people around a machine. So many people, I couldn't see what it was. But it was such a big deal that – and this is the only time I recall ever seeing this, although reading up on it, it was semi-common if a game was big enough. There was a second monitor mounted above it. So I almost felt like looking back, it was like I was at a wrestling show or something where you couldn't see the in-ring action, so you just watched the bigger screen. And I saw what looked like a movie in motion. I'd never seen such realistic – graphics before. And then one of them ripped the other's heart out, and Dad kind of whisked me out of the arcade. He's like, nope, we're leaving now. So
I've made a terrible mistake.
Yeah, exactly.
So that was, you went all the way in. You saw this game for the first time, and then you saw its most infamous feature, and a parent escorted you away at top speed.
That's right. It took a while. Actually, my mom was much more up for letting me play that game than my dad was. He took a couple of years, like through the home release of Mortal Kombat 2. By which time I was like, look, Dad, I know the blood code for the first game. This game doesn't have a blood code. I'm 11 now. I'm basically a man. Let me just play Mortal Kombat.
Well, I understand that. I mean, when I was 11, I believe 10 or 11, I saw RoboCop for the first time in theaters. And I feel like that's at least three times as violent as any Mortal Kombat. So I hear you. I hear you on an ascension to adulthood through the ingestion of blood and guts.
Yeah, this happened to poor Dad a couple of times because he grew up watching. So Batman's my favorite character, and I got that from him. But he grew up watching the 1960s Batman. So he took us, I think I was 7, to see the Tim Burton Batman. He was like, oh, yeah, this is going to be hilarious. It's going to be a good time. And then like 20 minutes in, he's like, do not tell your mom that I took you to see this movie, because this is not what I expected at all.
I thought Jack Nicholson would be fun in this movie.
Yeah,
it's fun, exactly, in a different way. Stuart, not Batman, Mortal Kombat Stuart. What happened?
Oh, well, my first exposure to Mortal Kombat was just the kind of moral panic around it, because that sort of came into the UK at a time when there was a general moral panic about video games. I want to say it was around orbiting the same sort of time as Night Trap, and Mortal Kombat got sort of roped into that as well. But it was never like pulled from sale, as far as I know, or anything like that, because the UK loves to have moral panics about things that are ultimately harmless. Like Child's Play 3, for example. But my first time actually playing Mortal Kombat was at a friend's house on the SNES version, and it was terrible because I think, as is well known, there was no blood in the SNES version. It was all replaced with what looks like sort of sweat. And instead of the fatalities, I mean, they were still down as fatalities, but it was just like Sub-Zero would just kick you in the chest and you'd fall over and die. And it wasn't really as good as, you know, freezing someone and then like pulling them in half or whatever it was he does in the first game. Yeah, there's no real competition. And in all honesty, while I did play the other Mortal Kombats, I didn't become a fan of it until much later, until like the sort of relatively maligned PS2 era, which is just me all over, to be honest. but no, I have a lot of love for Mortal Kombat, sort of with hindsight. I read the comics, the Malibu comics as well, back in the day. Those were really bad, but I loved them and I still kind of love them. My favorite thing about them is the fact that I think it's some kind of mandate that every character has to have their name on the page if they're on the page or something. So everyone speaks in like the third person, like, oh, you shouldn't have tangled with Kano, and Kano's in like big letters, like big letters. It's really cool. Anyway, don't read them. They're really bad.
It's like TV pilot writing. Every character has to address another character and use names, like full names. Like, oh, hello, Lieutenant James Gordon. I didn't see you there. All right. So was Mortal Kombat considered a video nasty? I know Britain had a problem with video nasties, right?
Yeah, I imagine it was. I'm sure that exact wording was probably used as well. But, I mean, in the defense of the panicking right-wing, like, newspapers, it was pretty extreme compared to pretty much almost any other game, unless you look at really obscure, I don't know, like PC stuff or stuff like Chiller and stuff like that. This was probably the first mainstream, like, blood and guts game that I can think of. I'm sure there's some I'm missing. There's plenty of Amiga stuff that's really violent, but not so much. Not since the days of Barbarian on the Spectrum had we seen such gore.
Thank you, Stu, for mentioning Chiller. That was the example thinking in the back of my head of a game that's really gross.
It's a horrible game. It's really unpleasant, even today, I think. But Mortal Kombat's lovely and pleasant. It's a great game.
In comparison, certainly.
Oh, yeah.
As for me personally, I'm pretty sure I saw it not in an arcade, but in a local card shop. There was a small shop in my suburban town. And even though this place really only could fit about like 10 adults packed in like shoulder to shoulder, they had 2 to 3 video game cabinets in there at all times. And as kids, we would pile in there and we would all play these games. And, you know, we played Street Fighter when it was out. And then sure enough, late, again, probably in the fall of October 92, this new game comes in and we're dumbstruck. We can't believe what we're looking at. We can't believe what it sounds like. We can't believe what it looks like. And obviously we don't know, you know, we don't know any of the secrets. So I'm pretty sure it wasn't until maybe either myself or someone else was playing and we're all sort of watching in awe. And then all of a sudden the computer, you know, we lost a match and the computer just kills you. And you're like, wait, I died? Do I get to play again? So, I think like a lot of things, the game sort of gave us a peek at what was underneath the hood before we ever learned about those things ourselves and how to do them. So just so the game sort of every once in a while would show you, oh, this can happen. You know, if you lose, you can die.
The interesting thing about that era was I remember going to school and telling a friend about it, and they were like, oh, get out of here. You know, that doesn't happen in video games. Video games are Mario and Nintendo, and that was the thing. You couldn't just go Google like Mortal Kombat guy with metal plate tears out heart and find video clips, right? Like you had to kind of see this stuff to believe it.
If you didn't, if you don't know that that's coming, that has to genuinely be terrifying the first time you see it. So with the sound effects and just the sudden viscera, that must be really upsetting. Back in the day.
Yeah. I don't know. Well, you know, as a 10-year-old kid, and the first Mortal Kombat was less over the top than the ones that followed. So you had these like really kind of primal screams and, you know, the sky going dark, and it was just like, wow, what did I just see? So maybe in retrospect, Dad was right to kind of escort me out of the arcade, because I just thought about that all night, like, what just happened, you know?
Yeah, there's a little bit of understatedness to the early ones, and in the later games, it's more like, I don't know, someone explodes into like 300 thigh bones or something. It's not quite the same.
Mortal Kombat 3, a cartoon. Yeah.
Let's step back for a second. Let's look at the bigger picture here. We're talking about Mortal Kombat. So it was a big hit, and it was innovative in a lot of ways, but almost a lot of its aspects sort of came before it, you know? Indeed, almost 10 years earlier, before we get into this, David, you've written an entire book on the subject. I wonder if you can possibly explain the Bally Midway Williams tangle, because I've read about it several times. I never understand what is it, one company? It became one company? Do you know how it works?
Even now, I will have to give you the abridged version, because unless I read my own damn notes, I will probably get something wrong.
All right. Better than nothing.
So there's Bally Midway, and then there's Williams, and they were competitors, and then eventually one absorbed the other, and the Midway name was just given to Williams Arcade Group. So to make this even more confusing, all the guys I would talk to who worked on Mortal Kombat, who worked on any quote-unquote Midway game, kept calling it Williams. And in my head, right, I was like, so wait, I'm going to have to look this up. Because is it Williams? Is it Midway? Nope, turns out it's both, depending on the year and the day and the time. And Midway was just kind of given to, you know, that's the logo you saw on the side of the cabinets. That's the logo you would see kind of in the copyright screen of the home versions, which Acclaim distributed but did not make. They gave those to yet other studios. It's a whole ball of yarn.
Well, almost 9 years before Mortal Kombat, in 1983, there was a video game based on the popular band Journey. This game was made by Bally Midway. And one of the quirks of this game is the fact that they actually took photos of the band and put their heads on little bodies. And then all the mini games you play in that Journey game are you actually see the members of the band Journey sort of like, you know, running and jumping, you know, with a big head on a little body. But like, it's them. You can see it. It's them. It's like the real people are in it.
Yeah, it was really interesting, because if you look at Journey and then about 5 years later, Williams did Narc.
Yes.
And that was kind of the tech side was pioneered by Warren Davis, who kind of took an interest in digitized graphics. And even like if you look at Journey or Narc now, it's really hard to pick those out as digitized characters in the same way that Mortal Kombat's characters were digitized, because those first two games really look cartoonish. The technology was still kind of a work in progress. And I think it's because, you know, in Journey, again, you just had the photos for their heads. Everything else was very cartoonish. And in Mortal Kombat, it was like top to bottom digitization. It looks like you're controlling movie actors.
Right. And the characters in Narc are very small. Considering like the overall screen real estate, the characters are relatively small, you know.
Can I just interject that I can't believe Narc is as early as 88, considering how it looks? Like, I would have put that in the mid-90s visually.
Yeah.
That's insane.
It is. And it's only kind of relative to Mortal Kombat that you're like, maybe this isn't quite the same thing. But yeah, like, it was very impressive for the day. And then, you know, Warren Davis left Williams, aka Midway, the game division, and went to do his own things. And he came back around the time that Ed Boon and John Tobias were working on Mortal Kombat. And one of the first things he noticed was the large character sprites. And he actually said, like, yes, finally, this is kind of what I wanted to see someone use my technology for, because, you know, instead of small characters, let's make them larger than life, because the graphics just look all the more impressive the bigger they go.
Absolutely. Let's also drop a note for Smash TV, the 1990 game, also by Williams. Smash TV does not have real people in it. It's all cartoon characters, but it's also very openly gross. You know, like there's a lot of blood. There's a lot of gore. I think when your character explodes, you can like see their body parts fly away. And of course, the infamous mutant man battle, like you're taking off his limbs, then you're taking off his head. And eventually he's just like a big bloody stump on like two tire treads. Like it's kind of nasty, but it's fun. It's ridiculous.
It was like the quintessential arcade game for that time, because it's just very eye catching for how gross it was.
And that same year, not Williams, although I think Williams / Midway / whoever now owns it, because it's been put on compilations, Pit Fighter was actually made by Atari. And that is a fighting game, and it has live action people in it, but it is no Mortal Kombat. It's really, I mean, okay, for the time, it was definitely like, oh, what is this? What the hell is this? Look, it's a game with real people in it, but it has a lot of faults. The animation is not handled very well. It is absolutely not gory. It's all just kind of like, I mean, they're almost like dolls. They're sort of like, they punch, kick at each other, and, you know, you might hit somebody, but everyone just sort of like bounces around. It's very choppy. I mean, certainly for me as a kid, I played it. Of course I did. But if you go back and revisit it now, you kind of look at it, you're like, oh, this looks like it's more like the mid-80s. It does not look like a 1990 game.
Yeah, I think the one thing that immediately stands out is that, you know, there's a pretty colorful cast of characters there, but you don't play as most of them. The three characters you can play are just muscular guys with sweaty chests and pants. And
right.
There's nothing as memorable as Mortal Kombat there. The funny thing is, I couldn't do this in time to include it in the book, but I spoke with Rob Rowe, who was in charge of the digitization in that game, who's now the head of franchises at Pixar. And he said it was, you know, they were really impressed with their game. And then a couple of years after it came out, they saw Mortal Kombat and they were like, oh, so this is how you do that.
Can I perhaps erroneously shout out Guardians of the Hood, which I think came out about 3 months before Mortal Kombat did. And it was sort of like a follow-up to Pit Fighter. And now I'm starting to think it may have never been released. And I've just made a fool of myself.
That's a real video game. I've heard of that. I've heard of that name before, but I do not know its release date off the top of my head.
Yeah, I think it was like mid-92, and it was a sort of a follow-up to Pit Fighter, but Guardians of the Hood, it's about as worth playing as it sounds, I suppose.
That was Atari. Wikipedia says June 92. So yes, it was it was out before Mortal Kombat proper, but
yeah.
I guess Mortal Kombat had already been tested at that point, so certainly they were already deep into the work on Mortal Kombat, but it wasn't out yet.
Sliding doors scenario, if things had gone differently, we could have been talking about Guardians of the Hood right now and mentioning Mortal Kombat as just a quick aside in the legacy summary. You know, we could have just been watching the Guardians of the Hood 2021 movie. But sadly, it wasn't to be.
Well, that's good. But thank you, Stu. Thank you for bringing that up example. Because, yes, it's very important to recognize that Mortal Kombat, for all its strengths, very little of what Mortal Kombat did was a first. You know, it was very much... The cast and crew were building on ideas, things they had seen in their childhood, things they had seen in the arcades, things they had done in their past, and they kind of put it all together, and that's where Mortal Kombat came from. It was an amalgam of people's lives and ideas and memories and fantasies. Everything is in there, you know, in the soup. And you mentioned David Arya, their names. So, yeah, the two, I would say, central figures of Mortal Kombat are Ed Boon and John Tobias. And I just want to stress this. So... Both were career guys, but they were very relatively early in their careers. Ed Boon was only 27 in 91 when he started working on Mortal Kombat. He had been in the pinball division before that. John Tobias was only 22. He had worked on Smash TV. He did artwork for Smash TV, drew a lot of things for Smash TV. And those two guys are sort of the central hub. I guess, David, maybe you could speak more to the Tobias Boon relationship there, or because you actually met these people, right? They are real people.
They are real people. So I've communicated. John prefers to do interviews over email. Ed is pretty hard to get a hold of because Warner Brothers is kind of gatekeepers to talking to literally anyone there. But they had both kind of left their mark in other industries, even as young as they were. I mean, John Tobias came from comics. He'd worked on some Ghostbusters issues, and Ed was programming pinball games. And I heard a funny story recently, not from him, but from someone who remembers him saying, like, oh, Actually, no, it was from him, because just recently he received an Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences Award, and he remembered being kind of surprised that there was any programming required for pinball games. He was just kind of programming the score and special effects on LED screens, but he wanted to do video games. And so I believe Ed was working on High Impact Football, John was working on Smash TV, and they just got to talking, and they said, you know, eventually we should do a game together. It should be this martial arts game. And it was just kind of their... wasn't even moonlighting, because it was just the subject of conversations until they were both finished with their current project. And Midway's manager said, oh, we have a slot to fill until NBA Jam comes out. Who can whip something up in like 6 months? And that's how Mortal Kombat started.
But yeah, there was an anecdote in your book, David, I just want to ask about. So Tobias and some of his friends who would eventually be the Mortal Kombat cast, they had already known each other for years, and they were trying to make a movie in high school. This was an amazing story from your book.
Yeah, so I think the ringleader was Dan Piscina, who was 10 years older than everybody, so that kind of made him the de facto ringleader. And, you know, he knew the others, such as Rich DeVizio, obviously Carlos was his younger brother, Ho Sung Pak, they'd studied martial arts together, and John Tobias was friends with Carlos and a couple other guys. They would hang out and read comics, draw. And John wanted to make movies. So in high school, he was given permission, since he was such a hard worker, made good stuff, to borrow a lot of the equipment. So he and his friends, who became the Mortal Kombat crew, they helped John pack all this stuff into his car. And they were in a car accident, not their fault. A lot of the equipment was smashed, and everyone was okay but shaken up. And that was kind of an early bonding experience that they all shared before sometime later when John would kind of call on them to play these characters for the martial arts game that he and Ed were finally being given a chance to make.
That's an incredible history. Just the fact that they already, you know, it's like they already had so many ideas. They already wanted to work together. It was only just a matter of happenstance that came together years later. It's like, oh, no, this is going to be the project.
Yeah, it was sort of happenstance after happenstance, because I, you know, from my understanding is John and Ed didn't have these guys in mind. It was just like, well, neither of us knows martial arts. We'd look kind of goofy trying to do kicks and punches and flips in front of a camera. Who do we know? And John was like, oh, I know some people, and just gave them a call and see if they wanted to pitch in.
And these people, yes, you've already mentioned several of their names, but yeah, Daniel Piscina, he was, you know, the older one at, you know, he was already 32, my goodness. His younger brother, Carlos, only 24, Richard DeVizio, 23. This is amazing to me, again, from your book, Ho Sung Pak, 24 years old. He was already in the Black Belt Hall of Fame before any of this happened.
Yeah, he was like the number one ranked competitor in the United States at that time, not just in winning martial arts matches, but in forms where you just watch them go through all these wild ornate moves with weapons. I mean, he was so accomplished, and, you know, some of them had even played stunt doubles in the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle 2 movies, which I didn't realize at the time. If you go back to certain frames, like there's a part early in the movie where Shredder kind of comes back from the dead, and all the foot soldiers and Tatsu are like, oh, Shredder, you survived being blatantly murdered by Casey Jones. And if you pause right there, you can actually see one of the guys with a shocked expression on his face is Dan Piscina. He and Rich played foot soldiers. So since they were masked, they said they'd get, you know, beat up in one frame and go out for a second and then kind of circle back in to play another foot soldier. And Ho Sung, probably because of his accolades by that point, was actually the stunt double for Raphael. So he actually got to be one of the main characters.
So he was a turtle. He's a legit turtle.
Yep, that's right. Got to sweat in those costumes, which are still awesome. I still love the costumes from those first two movies, but it just gave me a whole new appreciation watching them back and knowing that at any moment, you know, Raphael could have done a cartwheel kick and uppercutted any of those foot soldiers 30 feet into the air.
And of course, the Turtles met at least, I think, Scorpion in Injustice 2. There I've connected it to Mortal Kombat.
That's right. That's right. All these crossovers.
Another way.
Yeah.
It's other than the main way it's, you were discussing.
So. It's becoming as tangled as the Williams and Midway connection. Yeah.
But yes, so the concept, the Mortal Kombat concept, at least the quote we have here from your book, a martial artist turned movie star who gets wrapped up in a brutal martial arts tournament. And let's be honest, that's kind of Enter the Dragon. Like, it's kind of almost exactly Enter the Dragon, except, I don't know, Bruce Lee in that movie is not necessarily a movie star, but I think people watching it, he sort of looks like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
there's a very thin veil of, oh, this is, you know, original idea, do not steal, you know, our secret martial arts tournament on an island that you get to by boat, and there's a guy who sits in a throne and watches you, and yes, you saw this movie.
Yeah, and also very intentional because, you know, Dan Pacina, Carlos Pacina, Anthony Marquez, who was actually on deck to play Scorpion in Sub-Zero Mortal Kombat 1, but he hurt himself in the gym and couldn't get cast until Mortal Kombat 2 as Kung Lao. They all kind of worshipped at the altar of Bruce Lee. He was the guy. Everybody wanted to be Bruce Lee. And Ho Sung Pak, especially, you know, jumping forward a bit, if you look at him, his Liu Kang model in Mortal Kombat, the black pants, the white shoes, he's basically, they gave him a Bruce Lee type outfit to even wear.
He's making noises too. He's doing all the noises. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, although, the voices in all the games up until G5, I think, was Ed Boon. All of them. Even Liu Kang's, Sonya was probably Liz Malecki, who we'll talk about later. But all the voices, get over here, Liu Kang's battle cries, that was all Ed.
Geez, so if you ever interview Ed, you have to ask him what Raiden actually says.
Yeah, I doubt he'd even tell because he is like the master of keeping secrets. There are later chapters where I write about like John Tobias would find out that, oh, I did not even know this character was in the game. I need to go talk to Ed because he clearly put this in there just to pull one over on me.
Hmm. So that was their idea, very much Enter the Dragon. But, you know, this is 1991. Unfortunately, Bruce Lee had been dead for almost 20 years. So their idea was, well, what if, you know, I think they pitched the studio, you know, what if we get one of the contemporary action stars? And I'd heard Van Damme for years, but you said Steven Seagal was also in the running?
Yes, this was something I believe it was either John Tobias or Roger Sharp told me. Midway was very big on licenses at the time. And so when Ed and John pitched their martial arts game, the first thought was, okay, well, it can't just be a martial arts game. Who would play that? And so Roger Sharp, who was kind of the head of their marketing and licensing, said, okay, well, we have the opportunity to maybe work with Van Damme, maybe work with Seagal, pick one of those. And I think Van Damme probably would have been the better choice. I was always in the Van Damme camp in that era. I don't know what Steven Seagal would have brought to that, but it's kind of funny when you think about it. I mean, Van Damme obviously didn't work out, which ended up being the best thing possible for Mortal Kombat. But if Steven Seagal had... we would have totally been talking about Guardians of the Hood right now because no one
Steven Seagal got the last laugh by appearing in the Mega Drive game Steven Seagal is the Final Option, which was cancelled and no one has played it.
Yes, that was his final laugh for sure.
Yeah, he sat back in his like cigar throne and like tended his fingers satisfied that his work was complete.
Something tells me if Steven Seagal had said yes, he would show up and either wouldn't agree to filming or would only film moves that he would win, and he would not allow anyone to fatality him. You know, that's what I feel like would happen.
You're probably right.
He can't take my head off. What are you talking about?
But then you couldn't have a mirror match because it would never end.
Oh, that's true.
He would refuse to put himself over.
And he'd be like, well, can the final boss be maybe a transforming four-armed Steven Seagal who transforms into other Steven Seagals?
All his limbs are also Steven.
Yes.
Steven Seagal combat.
But this, as you said, they probably lucked out in that no celebrity got involved. So they were able to make the completely original character, Johnny Cage. And to me, the funniest thing, once you realize this, once you look at Johnny Cage in the game, you look at him and you really look at him and you're like, oh, he's literally dressed like Jean-Claude was in Bloodsport. Like, he's wearing the outfit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it even does the split punch, which, of course, was one of Van Damme's things. And it was all kind of a riff, not to even poke fun at Van Damme, because at the time he probably didn't even notice. But it was just like, hey, here's a Mortal Kombat kind of became famous for that. Like on the surface, it's all the blood and the gore, but all those winks and nods from developers to people who know became as much of a trademark, if not a bigger trademark, than the violence.
Yes, and before they arrived at their infamous name, they had a lot of working titles, including Kumite, which, of course, is a Bloodsport thing. They talked about Deathblow, Final Fist. I'm sorry, that would not have worked. Fatality. I kind of like Fatality, but then you worry about, you know, would the esports guy have to change his name? Dragon Attack, I think that's clever, but that sounds like the dragon shooter that what company made? I forget the one, but remember the vertical scrolling shooter where you have the dragon. You're actually
Dragon Spirit, I think it might be called. Yeah,
but yeah. So if you named a game Dragon Attack, I would assume I would either be playing as a dragon or fighting a dragon. Well, so I would be upset.
Mortal Kombat 2, they could have called it Dragon Attack.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Could have been a subtitle. Yes.
Yeah, it would have been weirdly specific, but they could have called it that.
Dragon Attack. You know that one move with Liu Kang. but yes, apparently they were from their many ideas on a whiteboard somewhere. Someone misspelled the word combat, and I guess there's a dispute as to who wrote what. But ultimately, they say Steve Ritchie said Mortal Kombat, and everyone is locked onto it.
That's right. Steve Ritchie was, I believe, still in the pinball division at that time. He was a friend of Ed Boon's, and Steve and Ed were talking in his office, and Ritchie just kind of saw that and said, "Oh, you should just call it Mortal Kombat with a K. That'd be funny." And Ed was like, "Yeah, that would." And then Ken Fidesna was one of the managers at Midway, and I got to talk to him. That was really cool because he kind of opened his notes to like sales units and stuff that only he and Neil Nicastro, who ran the place at the time, had access to. And he had gone to Japan and bought this this gold-plated dragon home with him. And John Vogel, who became the third member of the four-man Mortal Kombat team, was like, "Can I borrow that for a second?" And then they digitized it and put it in the game. It kind of became the logo. So maybe Dragon Attack. We keep coming back to dragons. Maybe Dragon Attack would have worked.
Well, I must say, Mortal Kombat, as far as logos go, the Mortal Kombat dragon is one of the great all-time logos.
It's but so yeah, good.
Yes.
I still think on a marquee, if you put Dragon Attack on there, I'd walk up to it and be like, "Where's the dragon? When did they get to the Dragon Attack?"
Yeah, it is. I have an affinity for video game logos that can be just the logos with no move or no words, and just tell you everything you need to know. And I feel like the Mortal Kombat is one of like maybe, I don't know, half a dozen that are that prolific that can do that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think just by the time the second game arrives, right, the Mortal Kombat logo itself is just like the victory marker. Like every time you get a win, you get like a little logo on the screen, right? So in one game, it's become sort of universally understood. Like, oh yes, this is our dragon. You know the dragon. It's our dragon.
Yeah, exactly. And everything, even you know, Liu Kang's dragon fatality that Stuart mentioned, they made sure to animate it so that it looked like the classic Chinese dragon that was the influence for the logo. So that dragon is just everywhere. It's just that iconic.
Mm-hmm. And even like the first thing you see in the movie as well, that burning.
That's right.
Logo. It's awesome.
Oh gosh. Yeah. That opening. Yeah. It spins That's around right. and the music comes. Oh geez.
Oh, it's so
oh
good.
Boy.
Also, also in later in the PS2 games, all the many currencies are all of the dragon logo coins.
I was thinking about that too. All the different colors. That's something they still use today in the modern games.
Yeah, except now you have to pay for them with real money.
Yeah. There are the advertisements all over the main menu. It's just not the same. Just not the same.
Do they have a clever name these days? Is it like the mortal coins with a K?
Coins with a K or currency
combat
with a
coins.
K.
Yeah, combat coins.
Combat coins. Combat premium currency. but thank you, David, for mentioning the gold statue, because I really feel like that story – you know, and other anecdotes really emphasize how this was such a handmade passion project. You know, it was a bunch of guys getting together with their friends. Everyone just sort of came together. They went, apparently you said they went to shoot all the actors in the same space that had been used for Narc. But in the years since Narc was made, it was just full of like a bunch of storage, right? So they had to all go in there and like all the actor stuff had to move all the stuff out of the way so they could actually film the video game.
Yeah, it was like the arcade office's equivalent of the kitchen junk drawer. Like there were there were car parts in there and they all had to haul this stuff out and then get set up. You know, John set up lighting in a certain way because he already had he and Ed had a mood and a look in mind that they wanted to go for. And that's part of, you know, a lot of people ask me like, "Oh, what did you learn?" And it still just kind of leaves me kind of gobsmacked that Midway's managers had no expectations for this. They were just like, "We have a slot on the schedule. We need something. You two want to make a game? Just go do it." Oh, and by the way, how about Jean-Claude Van Damme? Huh? How about that guy? And and all this went into it. But, you know, obviously Ed and John, even though their higher ups had no expectations, really didn't even care. They were like, "Well, we're not saying this is going to be like the greatest game of all time, but it could be pretty cool. And they just poured all their energy into this. And I feel like that's like this always happens to video game creators. You probably start out, at least if you're going into the AAA industry, you start out working on whatever you're assigned to, but you harbor these dreams of doing your own thing and kind of working night and day to make it happen.
Absolutely. And in the case of Mortal Kombat, you know, they all came together, and a lot of the costumes, according to your research, a lot of the costumes were just either – they were either their private clothes, or they would just go to a costume shop and just buy whatever they could find. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. So a lot of these guys, because they were professional martial artists, they had all sorts of, you know, like karate gis, weapon paraphernalia just kind of lying around. And otherwise, for a lot of games like NARC, there was a costume shop called Chicago Costume near the office within walking distance that John and Ed or Warren Davis or Eugene Jarvis or any of these guys would just go to, just kind of root around, find what looks cool, throw stuff on and get in front of a camera. And yeah, just the ad hoc nature of these games compared to something. I mean, I still really enjoy the modern Mortal Kombat games, but they have this really professional sheen to them that just kind of makes me whimsical for the era when they were like, oh yeah, you have can we buy a Phantom of the Opera mask and spray paint it gray for Kano's metal plate? That would look kind of cool. Just kind of throwing things together, and it turned out to just look so awesome.
I feel like they kept that kind of ethos all the way through the PS2 era as well, because as much as those games weren't as acclaimed, they still had that feeling of kind of like, well, what if we had like a version of Puzzle Fighter? We just throw that in. What about a racing kart game just as well? Just put it in there as well. Why don't we have a video of like cooking with Scorpion and put that in the game? And it just feels very like passion project again, which I really like. And then, as you say, the new ones are a lot more sort of slick, so it's kind of lost that a bit.
Yeah, that almost seems to happen to so many things. I mean, I guess it's just anything that becomes really big and has a lot of money behind it, that'll happen. But as a wrestling fan, you know, modern wrestling has its problems, but it's just so overproduced today, where if you go back and watch those shows, like the pyro would go off and there'd just be this haze of smoke hanging over the arena so that nobody could see anything for like the first 45 minutes. I'm like, that's Mortal Kombat 1. There's just smoke hanging everywhere and we're kind of all doing the best they can. But I you're right, not to go too far off track, but my friends and I loved the name of that kart racer, Motor Combat. That's really, really clever. And that game was super fun. And that's actually a lot of fans in the research. They're like, I wish they'd do stuff like that again. It felt like when you bought those games, you were buying like an anthology of games. Like Mortal Kombat was the main attraction, but you could very easily get sidetracked and all this other stuff that someone was just like, what if we throw this in? And that kind of, I mean, even in Mortal Kombat 3, you could play Galaga, you know, just all these little secret mini games hidden within the main game.
I like the wrestling comparison. I mean, that works considering that there was that WWF, I want to say WrestleMania, that was very Mortal Kombat-like. And they originally had fatalities in that, but let's save that for the wrestling games episode. And the Shockmaster, that's kind of Mortal Kombat-ish, I would say.
But anyway, moving on. Very much. Glacier? That's Sub-Zero. I mean, come on.
Yeah, it is Sub-Zero, yeah.
Let's dive into the characters a little bit, because I think one of the strong points of Mortal Kombat is, you know, are the characters they came up with. I guess most of the lore, quote unquote, is from Tobias, right? Most of it?
I would say that's accurate. Yeah. Although he and Ed Boon were just talking all the time. So there was this very free flowing exchange of ideas. But, you know, they were both martial arts movie fans. And so they had this stuff that they kind of wanted to recreate or put their own spin on. And I think the reason you can say most of it comes from John is he was the one who was ultimately in charge of writing things down, because in these days, Ed Boon was the only programmer. He was the only programmer through, I think, Ultimate Mortal Kombat 3. And so he had his hands full with the code, but that also gave him the opportunity to kind of tweak things to his liking and insert a lot of secret characters that they would retroactively develop lore for.
So we have, you know, we have the main guy, quote unquote, Johnny Cage. Apparently, one of his working names was Michael Grimm, which no, sorry, no, that's just not. That's not gonna work.
That's awesome.
That's such a comic book character name. That like Michael Grimm is Mortal Kombat, or you know, it just it has like a really corny ring to it. But then Johnny Cage probably had that same. It has a movie star quality to it. I really like that name.
It's a cool name. Yeah,
it is.
And as we said, he's dressed exactly like Jean-Claude's outfit in Bloodsport. He does the split. Daniel Pacina plays Johnny Cage. He said he'd do the split like 30 times during filming, so it was really painful. And they spent, because he was the first one, because he was like the test subject, the you know, the coal mine canary, if you will, they said they spent about a month just working on him to sort of like figure out what they were doing, right?
So, yeah, what happened is, you know, a lot of the guys came in for that initial test. And then Dan Pacina was the first one to film alone just to do Johnny Cage. And then Ed and John kind of decided, you know, like, let's basically make, I don't know if this term was in extant at the time, but it's what developers now would call a vertical slice. You know, let's make a complete character. Let's get a background, some sound effects. Let's just see if this is working. And that's kind of where, you know, John Tobias knew fellow John, John Vogel, who, you know, John Tobias would draw a lot of these things, like the stages by hand, and then John Vogel would kind of implement them. Dan Forden was their audio guy, who's just brilliant. I love the soundtrack for those early games, all the sound effects. And they basically got it to where you could do a mirror match with Johnny Cage. And that's when it was working well enough that they knew, yeah, let's keep going, because there's definitely something here.
Absolutely. And he's got, besides the splits, he's got the kick, and he can throw little fireballs. And I think, does he have an uppercut in the magic uppercut in the first game or the second game? I think he has a sort of launching.
Oh, yeah. Like we always called it the dragon elbow, because it looked like a dragon punch ripoff sort of thing. Right. And yeah, that's Mortal Kombat 2. And okay. That was kind of fun because, you know, Ed and John were like, well, let's give everyone a projectile. But then just as another example of the extemporaneous nature of what they were building, Ed kind of looked at the kick and was like, you know, I bet I could just make him like slide forward and have shadows trailing behind him. And John goes, oh yeah, that'd be cool. And so that's kind of how the shadow kick started. And it is such a really cool effect. It's one of the ones that really stood out to me as a kid, this guy with shadows trailing behind him.
And really that sort of shadow effect that predates what would become the norm in a lot of fighting games, but especially Street Fighter, you know, when you had like super moves, you'd have the super shadows behind you, mm-hmm. but this is way before any of those games got in, the super move thing. So, you know, that's foreshadowing. Hey!
Yeah! Mortal Kombat with its lore. I think the interesting thing was the timeline of Street Fighter and Mortal Kombat became pretty neck and neck almost near the end of Street Fighter 2's run. But, you know, Street Fighter 2 had a year in advance on them. But I remember in Mortal Kombat, they actually used the term mirror match, fighting the same character versus same character. And that was like in Street Fighter 2... You could not do that. The closest you could get was someone picks Ryu, another person picks Ken. They're basically, you know, they're a palette swap. But if someone got to Guile or Chun-Li first and that was your pick, then you were kind of out of luck. So it was pretty novel in Mortal Kombat that even though the cast was seven, one less than Street Fighter 2, two people could be the same character, which was very, very novel.
Right, which Street Fighter did not correct until they made the championship edition, in which case it was a big deal. It's like, oh, now you can play the same character. You know, holy smokes. Yeah,
I remember seeing that on the marquee along with "and play the bosses." It was I spoke to people from Capcom USA very recently, again, after the book, and I'll be publishing that interview separately. But they admitted, like, yeah, we kind of looked with a little bit of disdain on Mortal Kombat, but we were also scrambling to catch up and stay ahead of them in a lot of ways for what they were doing.
I mean, as soon as Street Fighter 2 was the hit that it was, I mean, you know, everyone had a fighting game. Let's, you know, we should really stress this. Like, there was the floodgates opened and every company who could make a fighting game made one. Just like when Mortal Kombat became a hit, suddenly anyone who could make a fighting game is like, oh, what if we also put lots of blood in it? Or what if we try to put people in it? Or, you know, some games try to do both. And I think very few games did anything as good as it, you know?
A club I used to get when I was a kid that I used to sort of hang out at sometimes, they had this incredibly obscure game, arcade cabinet, called Blood Warrior. And I couldn't tell you anything about that game other than it was the biggest ripoff of Mortal Kombat imaginable. It's just like, why even buy this? Why make this in the first place? It was astonishing. And that's like the tip of the iceberg for like all the games that, I don't want to say rip off Mortal Kombat, but are heavily inspired by it. Like stuff like Tattoo Assassins and Way of the Warrior. There's just an endless list of these digitized, gory fighting games that spun out from this one.
I think that's the interesting thing. Like, if you trace fighting games back, I think ultimately they trace to Street Fighter II, even Mortal Kombat. But
yeah,
when you add Mortal Kombat, every fighting game that came after was derived from one of those. You either had the Street Fighter clone or the Mortal Kombat clone. And I feel like that's true even today. You know, back then, resources being as limited as they were, it was a lot easier to make a clone of one of those two.
Yeah.
But today, even if you have, like, you know, King of Fighters, I don't remember if it was King of Fighters or Art of Fighting, which actually was started by the guy who made Street Fighter 1 and then left Capcom. But they look very different today, but they're still, I feel like today it's still Street Fighter and Mortal Kombat are still kind of the longest reigning fighting game standing, and ultimately other games draw comparisons to one of those two.
Mm. I guess the only remote exception would be something like Tekken and Soul Calibur, but they're still in debt to Street Fighter, I would say.
For sure, for sure. And even then, like, those are so rare today because we kind of realized, like, oh, 3D graphics are not maybe all we thought they were, but, you know, 3D graphics on a 2D plane. And then we kind of, you know, Street Fighter 4 kind of ushered that back in the same way Street Fighter 2 popularized it way back when. Mm-hmm.
So we were talking about the cast. So we had Johnny Cage, Liu Kang, played by Ho Sung Pak, and Liu Kang apparently named for Gordon Liu. So that's cool. Kano. What is Kano's deal? Did it ever establish what the face thing was, or was it just like, oh, this looks cool, I want to wear a mask?
it was very much an, oh, this looks cool, and a lot of things that John and Ed did was to kind of get people talking, because even back then they realized that like if you watch Street Fighter 2's attract mode for the lore, there was not much there. Like, if you were really curious about Ken's blood type, then that would spill the beans. But they wanted to design characters that were very eye-catching, and they even said, like, John even said, like, we didn't explicitly want them to watch the attract mode because we had to earn money on this thing, but if you did, you would kind of look at the characters and gain insight into, oh, so Kano is a mercenary, something happened to his eye, and oh, Sonya is after him, that's why she's here, and Scorpion is, you don't realize he's undead until he pulls off his mask and you see a skull breathing fire, and that tells you something's going on with this guy. And so that kind of, you know, tracing it back to Kano, it was like, how can we make these characters look really mysterious and get people talking, not just about, you know, what the game plays like, but who are these characters and how are they connected? How can we, everything was about spectacle and mystery for that first game, especially.
Well, speaking of spectacle, I think Raiden is definitely a character that, I think that was the first character that caught my attention. And I must admit, a failing of my youth, at that time, I had not seen Big Trouble Little China yet, so I didn't make the connection. But when I did see Big Trouble Little China a few years later, I was like, oh, okay. Because his entire outfit is exactly what the bad guys wear in Big Trouble Little China. You know, with the hat and everything. But to me, that was the hook for me. Like, that was my first go-to Mortal Kombat character, because, like, yeah, you know, the attract mode says he's like a god who's walking on the earth. And if you actually beat the game as Raiden, the ending sort of makes him like the bad guy, because if he wins, it talks about how he and his friends all come to Earth and they basically destroy it, you know, like either partying or fighting amongst themselves or something. But it's kind of like the bad end if you beat it with Raiden. So mm-hmm. It's kind of a, you know, the later games make him into some sort of hero, some sort of guardian, you know, protector of Earth, like he's Doctor Who or whatever. But no, in the first game, he's just he's a bastard. He doesn't care about us. He's here to, you know, he's here to win the tournament, I guess, for his own reasons.
I would argue the later games make him into an idiot, but that's a discussion for another time.
Yeah, Raiden flip-flops between good and bad more than Big Show in WWE, I guess.
He makes bad decisions.
He makes terrible decisions based on emotion, which you would think for a god was maybe something that wouldn't happen that often. But then again, I don't know. That kind of seems like a lot of what religion is predicated on. But I didn't make that connection either. I hadn't seen Big Trouble in Little China, and I actually had to be reminded, one of the early readers, they were like, oh, you know, Raiden was actually kind of a bad guy until, you know, a later game. And I was like, oh, that's right. Like, I went back and read his bio and everything. And it just goes to show, like, how we think of Raiden now and how we thought of him for so long. He was a bad guy for a much, much shorter period of time than he was ever the good guy, the protector of Earth's champions like Liu Kang and Johnny Cage.
Right. And of course, when the first movie comes out, you know, Christopher Lambert plays him like Loki or something. He's just there, like, he's, you know, he's laughing it up. He can't. Everything's funny to him.
Yeah, there's even that really the moment that always stands out to me, like, the fate of the world is in your hands. Sorry. I was like, what is this movie? But it was like, it was great. They weren't really playing it straight. Like, that's something that Ed Boon and John Tobias did not like about the first movie. Like, Raiden is kind of acting like sort of a clown, but it was a lot better than what came in Annihilation. So when you compare those two movies,
oh boy,
yeah, the Raiden in the first movie was a-okay after that.
And so we should get to the ninjas. You know, the other two characters are basically one character. It's one guy with a palette swap. You know, I mean, but hey, Street Fighter did it. Everyone did it. You know, no fault. But both
I would argue that by the time they got to like Mortal Kombat Trilogy, and you had Scorpion, Sub-Zero, Reptile, Rain, and Ermac, that they might have been pushing it slightly.
And Human Smoke. And
oh, yeah. Human Smoke, yeah, I forgot about Smoke and Noob Saibot. I forgot they had these many ninjas, God.
Yeah, it was pretty absurd, but it was an easy way to save.
That would have been a good name for the game, Too Many Ninjas.
Yeah, I think I called the chapter in the book Ninja Fest, because that's how one of the people I talked to described it, like, yeah, all the ninjas, and it's really interesting. You can go check out now, just recently, as of the time of recording this, Ed Boon has been releasing behind the scenes footage of things like how they came up with Scorpion's spear and the get over here cry. And Scorpion was done first. And that was just kind of practical because Ed, as the programmer, was like, well, we can fit one more character in there if we just do a palette swap, and it should be the ninja. That way you don't see any faces and we can give them their own backgrounds and everything.
But to their credit, they actually do have some unique animations. You know, I always think of Scorpion. You know, listeners, you can't see me, but Scorpion sort of like he always got like his fist raised, like he's almost like he's palming the spear, like he's ready to throw it. Whereas Sub-Zero is more, you know, he's more cool. You know, his hands are just sort of like you know,
he's more cool.
Yeah, we see what you did there.
Very cool guy.
If you'd like to learn more about the history of Sub-Zero and Scorpion, why not go and play Mortal Kombat Mythologies Sub-Zero on the PlayStation 1 console?
I could tell you why not.
I did that. I'm not going to do it again. No.
I did that too. The funny thing is, like, I liked that game. I acknowledge that it had a lot of problems, but like, Mortal Kombat 4, again, unlike Street Fighter fans, if you were into the lore, Mortal Kombat Mythologies was must play, and it was pretty good from that perspective. But I remember one thing that I was a stickler for accuracy in the home versions, and on the Sega Genesis version, Scorpion and Sub-Zero both had Scorpion stance, and I was like, no, this is not, this is why I was mortal, you know, because I would point out things like this. And, even their, everything from their stances to their special moves, that's when they kind of had their own animations, and it's part of what made them, distinct. And actually, to go back to Raiden real quick, one of the effects that my friends and I thought was cool was how he had lightning crackling around him.
Oh, yeah.
As he played. And that was like, they didn't bring that back from Mortal Kombat 2. And that was always kind of disappointing because it was one of the coolest little special effects in the first game.
I also always enjoyed his teleport animation where he just sort of like descends into the ground and comes back up. Yes. And I know that for whatever reason, the AI, it was always Raiden. if you swept Raiden repeatedly, he would usually fall for it. So I had a lot of matches where I would just sweep him until the match ended. But if I played as Johnny Cage or anyone who did like a really fast fatality, I could sweep, 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 and then quickly do the fatality before he sort of materialized. And it would make this weird graphical effect where the body would be discolored, but the head would be normal and the head would fly off and would just be this brightly colored body falling down. And I just thought it was the funniest little, you know, it's obviously a bug, but I just thought it was hilarious.
Yeah, there was one other one like that where if the final hit when you're playing Sub-Zero knocks them down and you quickly freeze them, I think if it says finish him or her and then you do the freeze, that counts as your hit and the match ends. But if the freeze connects before the soundbite can finish, they'll be blue. And then if you rip their head off, their body will still be frozen as it slumps to the ground. And I think everyone as a kid, like no matter which character you thought looked the coolest, Sub-Zero and Scorpion seemed to be the favorites. But one thing I learned in the course of writing this book was that they are actually the bottom of the barrel in terms of the tier list. So I not only talked to developers to write this, but I talked to a lot of fans, including pro players. And I learned that Sonya was actually number one, because not only was she the most mobile, but her leg grab to what you were saying, Diamond, if you time the leg grab right so that you caught them as they were getting up, human or AI, they could not block in time. The game was like, no, that they're still in the standing up phase and they're defenseless. You could infinite leg grab them to death. And Johnny Cage was number two. And this was just really surprising to me because you would think, oh, well, the ninjas are cool because they have the stun moves that leave you open for a free hit. But it was actually a lot of the characters who not only looked cool, but were the most versatile that are actually considered top tier by people who actually still play these older games professionally.
Well, one of the most interesting things about Mortal Kombat to me, and it certainly made it stand out at the time, and I think still does, is the fact that all the characters basically have the same moves. Like, in Street Fighter 2, you know, every character has three punch attacks and three kick attacks, and they're all, you know, sometimes exquisitely, uniquely animated. You know, Guile's crouching heavy kick is this weird sort of double kick where he swings his entire leg out and then swings his entire leg out again. Like, if you block one, you have to block the second one or you'll still get knocked down. Whereas everyone in Mortal Kombat is basically the same. You push the button, they have the high punches, the low punches, they've got the roundhouse, they've got, of course, the uppercut, but like the moves, you know, posing aside, they're basically the same character. And that was a big surprise to me. And I think I think in the book you mentioned, David, that it was intentional because they just wanted to make it easier to sort of play around, right? Like to have people sort of just test new characters or...
Yeah, so for the longest time, I would say until Mortal Kombat 9 in 2011, Mortal Kombat was kind of considered the poor man's fighting game because that same accessibility, which was intentional on John and Ed's part, was looked upon with derision by Street Fighter fans. You know, like they say, oh, well, if I'm Honda and I do a standing fierce, that's an overhead chop. I can swat you right out of the air. But in Mortal Kombat, all these clowns have the same normal moves. It's just about spamming the specials. But that's something that, you know, again, you could pick up Mortal Kombat with any character and you were kind of on even footing. It was about learning their specials and how to do the juggle combos, which were super advanced at the time and very damaging. That's what sets you apart playing Mortal Kombat.
Yeah, the juggling thing was also a big surprise for me because, you know, in Street Fighter 2, you know, once you take a hit, generally speaking, if you're being knocked down, if you get a hit and you're falling to the ground, you have this sort of window of invulnerability. And when you get up, you have a few seconds of, well, not even sec, like a split second of invulnerability. So you can get up and you do the wake up dragon punch or whatever. But in Mortal Kombat, you're basically, you always have a hitbox. So if the character, you can be attacked at any time. And if you're really good at the game, you know, as these pros are, you know, you can do a hit and then you can throw a punch and you hit people before they hit the ground and you'll hit them again. And if you do enough punches, you can bounce up into the air and maybe punch, and then jump kick them out of the, like, it's amazing. You know, some of these combos are really amazing.
Yeah. And I was told that by John that, you know, he and Ed figured that out. It was unintentional, but they left it in because they said, well, maybe someone will figure this out. And because of that, until later games, there was no damage mitigation. Every blow you landed did as much damage as it did all on its own. And so depending on who you were using, like with Raiden, if you could high punch someone out of the air, jump kick them, and hit a torpedo, That was like 45% of their life bar gone in three moves. And if you did that to someone in an arcade who was playing real money, depending on their temperament, like, you might be in a lot of trouble there. I heard all sorts of stories from people who, not because of Mortal Kombat, but just because, you know, there was money on the line. Like, a lot of arcades, the unwritten rule was you do not throw, because that's like 25% of health, and we're all paying money to play this, so let's keep it cool, let's keep it legit here. And that was actually where the illusion of everyone in Mortal Kombat having the same moves was somewhat dispelled, because there are things like, so with the ninjas, if you do a jumping punch with them, they kind of punch straight ahead of them. Mm-hmm. Johnny Cage punches down, so that's where his hitbox is. And so because of that, if you launch someone into the air in a corner and then you jump straight up and punch, their fist is low enough that when you pop them back up, you will hit the ground before they even start to descend. And in early versions of Mortal Kombat, you could just infinite jump punch them in the air with Johnny Cage until they were dead. And that did not go over well in certain arcade environments.
I think Iron Man can just do that in Marvel vs. Capcom 2, though. So, you know, it's...
So there you go. And that's, to go back to what we were talking to, how Mortal Kombat and Street Fighter are kind of the two archetypes, I think ground-based combos where you have really intricate strings of moves, even though Mortal Kombat did that later, it wasn't as freeform. You know, Mortal Kombat 3 added dial combos where it was like a phone number. You have to dial this specific number or it doesn't work.
Right.
That's still really Street Fighter's calling card to me, whereas juggles, which are still a huge thing in NetherRealm's games, the former Midway Chicago, that to me is, that's a Mortal Kombat style combo, not just a juggle combo.
Actually, before we move on, I just want to really quick touch on, we almost dropped her out because, honestly, the developers almost didn't have her in the game. Let's talk about Sonya Blade, because when the game launched in April 92 as a test, they only had the 6 men in it. So Sonya was added later. Can you talk about that story? Because that's literally, no one thought about adding a lady until after they touched the game in public.
Yeah, so nothing against John and Ed there, but it just kind of shows what the mentality was, not only among players, but among developers at the time, which it's doubly weird when you think about it, because we'll get more into this, but they didn't set out to make the antithesis of Street Fighter, but like Street Fighter had Chun-Li, right? Mm-hmm. So you'd think that you need at least one woman to counter that. But yeah, it was just the 6 male characters. And then Ken Fidesna in meetings with Neil Nicastro was like, we need at least one woman in here. And so Daniel Pacina, again, the oldest of this group of friends, knew a younger woman around 17 years old named Elizabeth Malecki.
That blows my mind. Literal teenager.
So young. And she was into dance and physical fitness. No martial arts experience whatsoever. But they brought her in, cast her. And either Dan or another one of the martial artists was on set at all times to say, okay, now we need you to do a high punch, try something like this. And you can see Liz Malecki's footage. And obviously she doesn't know as much as these other guys about martial arts, but she caught onto it very quickly because she's limber. She was in great shape and she could do this handstand, which John and I were like, we could do something with that. And it was really interesting just casting her because I love the irony there that the actor with the least amount of martial arts experience became the most dominant character in that version of the game.
So did she also kiss people and turn them on, light them on fire? That was a thing that she just did in her personal life, I guess?
That was definitely her personal life. She was really shy about it, didn't talk about it much. There were some outstanding warrants, as I understand. But no, in a lot of stories, you'll hear that Liz Malecki was the one. She wasn't really vehement about it, but she was like, fatalities. I don't know if I'm comfortable with that. I don't want to do something too gross. And so it's funny because in the context of Mortal Kombat, like getting burned alive to be reduced to a charred skeleton is tame relative to the other fatalities in the game. But that was kind of her thing. And she was comfortable with it more because like it was kind of funny, this kiss of death. And she carried that. Sonya still has that in the modern games.
You know, we were cracking on Annihilation before, but I kind of like how they worked in the kiss into Annihilation, how she it didn't make any sense, but it also, but the kiss doesn't make sense anyway. So like it, it didn't make sense in the right way to me. It's like, oh, she picked up some powder and it's flammable powder. You know, maybe it's magnesium.
The whole movie doesn't make sense.
No, it's kind of funny because this is still something. So I've been pretty entrenched in the fan community, which are actually like the most positive group of fandom out there. And this is, they love to debate these little lore things. They're not overly serious about it, but they're like, hey, what do we think this is? And there has been a long raging debate about whether Sonya's things like her kiss of death or her, the pink rings that she fires, is that magic or is that energy from some device? Because one of the themes that John and Ed wanted to go for was this clash of tradition via magic and progression via technology and how they kind of meet head to head. And even in some of the other arcade games, such as MK3, you know, Sub-Zero's story is he defects from the Lin Kuei because they are involuntarily turning all of their ninjas into cyborgs. Yes. And, you know, progression, it can't be stopped. You gotta run away and keep your freezing powers to fight these robots.
Yes. That's why that game had cyber ninjas.
Yes. And 3000 rib cages when you would explode because of, you know, cyber ninjas.
With dreadlocks. The dreadlocks are the one that really get me.
I love the dreadlocks, yeah.
Would it be fair to say at this point, I'm not sure if it's something to get into, but talking about how they originally didn't have a female character in the game, do you think that there's a degree to which there is that kind of taboo of violence against women? Because when we talk about Street Fighter, that's one thing, but here we're talking about ripping heads off and like putting holes in people's chests and pulling their hearts out and stuff. And I do wonder if that was a factor at all.
John never mentioned that. It seemed to be them to just something they kind of overlooked, because, you know, they even like Goro and Shang Tsung were kind of late additions as well, but it very well could have played a part there. And you're right. It was different. Like Street Fighter II, I feel like another hallmark of those games has always been just gorgeous animation and aesthetics. And it was different. It was kind of like watching a bloodless anime fight. Yeah. Whereas, yeah, like you're right. Like ripping Sonya's head off is definitely different than, you know, sending Chun-Li through the crate. That was oddly placed in Guile's Air Force stage.
Yeah. Empty crate.
The empty crate, yeah.
Well, it's funny. I guess it's just maybe just coincidence, but I always thought that Sonya looked to me like Cynthia Rothrock. You know, I don't know what her discipline was, but she was in a lot of early martial arts films. I don't know if it was karate or kung fu or what her deal was, but she did a lot of martial arts movies at that, you know, in the 80s and or 90s, and I felt like Sonya had a look that was very similar to hers, but maybe it was just that's just how Elizabeth likely looked. I don't know.
Yeah, it was just kind of how she looked at the time. It was also like her outfit was really interesting. Like Sonya to me always looked like kind of what Liz Malecki was, like into aerobics and stuff rather than a lieutenant who's chasing down one of the world's most deadliest mercenaries. And they kind of straightened that out with Katana and Melina in Mortal Kombat 2, who still showed some skin, but not nearly as much. And I guess it kind of became like, however it started, the female characters in Mortal Kombat are ended up being some of the best. So Princess Katana is my favorite character in the entire mythology, just because of how that combination of beauty and grace and that all started with Sonya, even though she literally was forgotten about until they realized, oh, yeah, we kind of do need a woman in here.
You mentioned favorites, so yeah, I've already sort of tipped my hand. I said that Raiden was my early favorite. That was the one I played the most. When you started playing Mortal Kombat, who was your guy or girl?
It was Sub-Zero or Scorpion. I mean, Scorpion kind of had the edge because not only did he have a move that could leave you stunned, but his spear actually did a little bit of damage. And sometimes that was like the last hit you might need to win a round, even if they blocked. But it was definitely one of the ninjas. And I think that it's always kind of funny to me how Liu Kang was positioned as the hero of those early games. But really, like, the ninjas were the most iconic. That's who everybody talked about.
Well, I mean, they're eye-catching, you know? It's definitely like the characters that grab your attention. The attract screen, they have the most story to them. They establish that they hate each other. And, you know, Liu Kang's kind of just a guy. He's really good at what he does, but he's also just kind of like a guy.
Yeah. Although, like, the more I played the games, the more respect I had for Liu Kang, because they did some really interesting storytelling in Mortal Kombat. One of the questions I asked John Tobias was, you know, for the other six characters, when they do a fatality, the sky turns dark and that ominous music plays, but Liu Kang's stays light and the music doesn't play. Why is that? And he said, well, it's because he's fighting there for honor. He's trying to, you know, save Earth and represent his temple. But then in Mortal Kombat 2, his people have been slaughtered. He starts to go darker a little bit. And I thought that was kind of cool. Like, I'm a big fan of storytelling in games that is either environmental or just kind of told through a character's actions. And I thought that was, again, one of the many, many ways that Mortal Kombat kind of distinguished itself from Street Fighter. The fatalities kind of tell the story. Again, Scorpion, you didn't realize he was undead until he exposes his true face in his fatality.
I think that, like, even outside of the more subtle stuff, NetherRealm, as they're called now, they've always been pretty good at storytelling in their multiplayer fighting games, or catering to have a reason why someone might want to play them in single player.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I've always thought the story of Mortal Kombat was interesting, even down to stuff like already mentioned MK Mythologies, which is not a great game, but the fact that it even exists is just kind of cool. It has those nice sort of FMVs that flesh out the story of, for example, Mortal Kombat 4, which is heavily based on it, I think, if memory serves. Like, characters like Shinnok and Quan Chi appearing in MK4 and stuff. And all the way through that, like, all the way down the line, they maintained the same basic plot until Armageddon. Then even after Armageddon, the reboot was about time travel, so Armageddon still happened. It's crazy. It's been a little while since I played that, so I might be misremembering that, but even today, with the really extensive, like, story modes where you're essentially watching a movie and then occasionally doing the fights, they're really, really entertaining, and they really do put a lot of love into their characters and their characterization, which I appreciate.
Yeah,
the little anime movies they've been putting out have been really quite enjoyable as well.
Oh, yeah. They're really kind of firing on all cylinders there. And I think you're right. I think I'm not bashing Street Fighter here, because I enjoy both. But, you know, you couldn't make a Mythologies type game with any of the characters from Street Fighter, because there just wasn't a lot of depth there. That and their timeline, their chronology is so weird, because a lot of these later numbered games are actually, like, they take place between 1 and 2. Mm-hmm. And so I always felt like when Street Fighter 5 added a story mode, I was like, it's kind of too late. I don't really care at this point, honestly. But the one thing that people loved about this first Mortal Kombat, and you didn't realize this until 2, was that the endings, not all of them are canon. It wasn't until 2 when you figured out which characters were returning and how the endings actually shook out that you realized, oh, okay, so Raiden's not actually a bad guy. Now he's this. And so there was a lot of speculation as to what things meant in the game, what fatalities were kind of signifying or telegraphing, what the endings meant, if they would carry over to the next game. And it's always been fun for the community to kind of compare those to the modern storytelling. As entertaining as I find NetherRealm's, you know, more cinematic games,
yeah,
something was kind of lost there, because everything is explicitly laid out. You're told and shown exactly who lives, who dies, what their connections are. In the arcade days, it was almost kind of like it was Demons and Dark Souls before those games, where there's just a lot of speculation around how things are connected and what they really mean. And I feel like that's something that is lost today, again, through the more explicit theatrical style story modes.
Can we put you on record as saying Mortal Kombat is the Dark Souls of the fighting game?
Absolutely. Sorry, do it. Okay. I'm sure people would love that. I'm sure it'll go over. And even as much as I love those games, I know that this is the Dark Souls of, you kind of roll your eyes, but the comparison is there, right? Like, nothing is explicitly laid out. Even if I feel like if Mortal Kombat, the originals, would have had cutscenes, they would have been just as vague and kind of weird as the Souls games.
I'm not getting bogged down in new games, obviously, but playing Mortal Kombat 11 and running around in the crypt, you come across a lot of things that are just oblique references to the old games that you'd only get if you'd almost read obscure tie-in novels and things like that. And I love that they are willing to do that still.
Yes.
That they're still there. That soul is still there in those games. And you have to kind of dig a bit further for it now, unfortunately.
Yeah. And it's also, I think just one more note about the cinematic modes. It's always funny to me that despite the urgency, like the life or death stakes, fate of the world is in your hands, all the characters enter scenes by just like walking in.
Yes.
They're just walking up like, hey guys, what's going on? We decide the fate of the world yet? And there's just kind of more urgency, I think, in the early games and the arcade games. Yeah, in fact, it's their endings. It's just really, again, it's really kind of fun to compare and contrast where these games started and where they are now.
You know, if we're going to talk about Mortal Kombat lore, I just want to give a quick shout out to the Mortal Podcast, which is a fascinating podcast that goes... Each episode dedicates itself to one character and goes through their entire story, you know, from the beginning to the end. Mm-hmm. And it's really, you know, as someone who's kind of dropped off Mortal Kombat in the later years, it's been really fascinating to tune into that show and find out, you know, which character from the early games becomes a different character later in games and which character was died but then came back, but then also went to hell on like a side mission and then, you know... found a part-time job, and it's like all these weird things. Like it's a really good show, and I think there's an episode where he does talk to John Tobias, so it was I really recommend looking up that show, Mortal Podcast.
I do find it laudable that they aren't afraid to make these changes. Like there's a whole like series of games where Liu Kang is essentially a zombie.
Yes,
there's, I mean, nowadays you're playing as the main cast's children while the main cast are just old and still knocking about, basically. Which, or I don't know if they're children or nephews or what, I forget, but characters like Cassie Cage and Jax's daughter is in there as well, I believe.
Yeah, it's a little bit of both, because like I know in Mortal Kombat X, like I don't remember his name, but one of the characters is like Kung Lao's nephew or Blind Kenshi's yes. nephew, but then like Cassie Cage is the daughter of Sonya and Johnny Cage, which who would have thought that would have ever happened, sort mm-hmm. of thing. Yeah.
I just think it's cool that they're not afraid to change these games instead of just repeating the same beats over and over again. I mean, they did do a more or less full reboot where they had a good excuse to repeat some of the same beats, but they're not afraid to evolve it, which I do think is laudable.
Yeah, I agree with you. And that's something that goes back to the arcade days for me. I think one of the reasons I gravitated to Mortal Kombat was while Capcom kept hammering on Street Fighter II until just nobody really cared anymore, Midway was putting out sequels with new aesthetics. And that was a big thing. When Mortal Kombat 2 came out, you realize that some characters are missing and you're like, well, wait, where are they? Because you're kind of, you know, if you're playing Street Fighter 2, you're used to the cast always being there, but now there are more of them. Sort of thing. And it just kind of, there was a continuity to Mortal Kombat, and just the fact that its lore could change, the characters could die, or, you know, another little Easter egg. You could see Sonya and Kano imprisoned on Shao Kahn's arena. It just became another distinguishing factor. Like, wow, Mortal Kombat actually has a story and it's moving forward instead of expansion after expansion after expansion. Mm-hmm.
You know, I recently wrote about this, but it still stuns me. You know, in the time between Street Fighter 2 and Street Fighter 3, Mortal Kombat started, blew up, and then abandoned 2D. Like, all that is in that gap, you know, 92 to 97. Because I think 97 is when Mortal Kombat 4 comes out, right? Or is it 98?
You're thinking of 97 was the arcade, 98 was home version.
Right.
Yeah, it was just really interesting there. And even Mortal Kombat 4, which was, you know, the most poorly received of the arcade games, it was still that it was in a weird place because it was a 3D game, but the most of the fighting still took place on a 2D plane, but it was still moving this story forward. Whereas, you know, Street Fighter 3 was great, but something else I write about in this book, it was so complex. Fighting games eventually were getting to the point where they were scaring away the casual players, which Mortal Kombat was still doing well. It's just that by that point, there was kind of an oversaturation of Mortal Kombat and Street Fighter, I would say.
I agree wholeheartedly. Stu, I'm sorry, I didn't get... What was your favorite character, Stu? Or did you not have one until PlayStation 2?
Oh, God. I'd have to say Scorpion again, but mostly because I knew how to do the spear.
Right.
I think it was... memory says, I think it was back and one of the punches.
Low punch,
Very easy to pull off. when you don't know how to play games, that's very appealing, you know? You could get the thing, you could pull off the spear, lure them in and do the uppercut for quite a lot of damage. And then I would just do that over and over. If you want to ask me which is my favourite character in the later games, we'll save that for a later podcast, I suppose. But no, this one definitely I'd have to say Scorpion, although I am quite keen on Goro, but you don't really get to play as him.
No, but I'm glad you mentioned Goro, because Goro is not an actor. They could not find a four-armed man in Chicago, so they they went ahead and made a puppet. And I think at the time, I mean, I was old enough to recognize that it was a puppet. You know, I looked at it like, that's a puppet. But to me, I was like, this is a good puppet. It works.
It's a really good puppet.
Yeah.
I'm sure I read somewhere, it might have in fact been in your book, that they made it with, like, strings like a real puppet, and then they were just like, why didn't we just give this thing, like, articulation so we didn't have to do this?
Yeah. Which I love. Yeah. No, Goro was so cool, and he tied into the lore really well, too. And the match before him, it always took place in his lair. Mm-hmm. And if you hadn't fought Goro, you didn't know this was him, but there was something really big and heavy kind of stomping around above you. And then when you win that fight, Goro just drops down and the fight against him begins. And I just thought that was the coolest thing that no other Mortal Kombat has really topped. Just once you know it's Goro, you know he's arcade level cheesy. You know, he was designed to take your money, but as far as the cinematic quality of his introduction, I can't think of another boss battle in a fighting game anyway that had a really cooler introduction in that era.
I mean, honestly, you'd say that it's unfair that he's like reading your inputs or whatever, and I just say he's got four arms. Like, of course he's going to be better at fighting than anyone else. He has twice the number of arms. I mean, come on, how many punches can you throw?
He's, yeah, barely one. Yeah. I guess that's a good point.
He can hold you with two of the arms while just repeatedly punching you with two of the others. And that's just, I mean, how are you supposed to be that? You shouldn't be able to beat him. It should be unbeatable.
Yeah, that's true. And he is a half dragon. So there's that dragon attack connection again. It's not half dragon attack, though. But
No, that's true.
Do dragons have four arms?
The dragon that Liu Kang transforms into has arms, tiny vestigial looking ones.
Yes.
Yeah.
Just like Breath of the Wild dragons have arms.
Yeah.
Yes. T-Rex arms.
Mystery solved.
Yep.
And last boss, Shang Tsung. And I got to say, in case our listeners were not there, in the 90s, everyone was crazy about morphing. You have to understand. Morphing was just a thing that was like, oh my God, you can morph? Can you morph in this game? Does this movie have morphing in it? You know, I mean, T2 was 91, and that was, you know, of course, the T-1000 could change shapes, and Michael Jackson's Black or White was 1991 that also had the morphing sequence at the end.
I just wouldn't watch stuff if there was no morphing. I just would reject it on principle. And then one day along came the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, and I was like, hello.
Yep. That has morphing in the title.
Morphing every episode, at least one morph. Yeah. You know, there was an old British claymation character called Morph, who I think stands at the apex of this trend.
Yeah, and the X-Men cartoon had that guy named Morph who was just there for the first episode so he could get killed.
Yeah, that's why I never watched it again, because obviously the loss of Morph, I had no reason to tune back in. Then later I find out they actually brought him back, and I feel like I've been hoodwinked, you know?
Well, just watch the episodes with him in it. That's the only lore you need, the Morph lore. Mm.
But yeah, Shang Tsung, the whole gimmick is Shang Tsung can be all the other characters, and he's got the magic effects. I also like how Shang Tsung doesn't actually walk or stand. He just kind of floats. I like that.
Yeah, it was really kind of a mystical boss. And, you know, the cool thing was, like, you didn't want him to morph because he really didn't have any moves of his own other than firing what would seem like an endless stream of those flaming skulls. But if you could keep him from morphing, you could just jump kick him over and over and over, because if memory serves, he could not block. And so he was a lot easier to beat than Goro, unless he morphed to Goro, in which case you were in for a bad time.
I want to make two small observations about Shang Tsung, if that's okay. I'm sorry my observations are taking up a fair amount of the runtime here. But first of all, he reminds me a bit of that Simpsons bit where there's one small sort of Yakuza guy outside not doing anything. And Homer's like, but look at him. He's going to do something. You know it's going to be good. And that's how I feel about Shang Tsung, because after Goro, he's quite unimposing, you know. He's just like an old dude, but no, he in fact can transform into everyone. And second of all, I want to shout out the PlayStation ports that had Shang Tsung and his morph ability because they had to pause to load every time he used it, which is hilarious.
Yeah, he was. I remember that's one reason I preferred the N64 version of Mortal Kombat Trilogy over the PlayStation version. In fact, a lot of people did. But also in Mortal Kombat 4, they didn't bring Shang Tsung in because they couldn't do the morphing to change polygons into other characters. So they gave that boss Shinnok. I don't remember what it called, like mimics or impersonations. But the funny thing was, the AI never did them, not ever. And so you were just fighting this guy who had no special moves and who could kind of morph but never did, and he was really just the pushover.
What makes me kind of mad about that is that, in NK Mythology, Shinnok, in fact, could transform into a giant monster and did. So,
so why not just do that?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, Goro, they added Goro to the home versions, and I feel like he was kind of necessary because you get the Shang Tsung, and that's basically Shinnok, and that's basically the end of the game. So they had to throw Goro back in there just to be a terror again.
You mentioned, Stu, that Shang Tsung was not intimidating, but again, in hindsight, Shang Tsung, he's just Lo Pan from Big Trouble Little China. He's not quite as tall as Lo Pan, but it's basically Lo Pan.
I have to admit, I haven't seen that movie. It is on my list. But for me, it's just a matter of, like, you got this huge guy with four huge tree trunk arms, and then you've just got this sort of slightly dodgy looking, like Mr. Miyagi type sort of fella.
Yeah.
And I just kind of get like, I don't know, not so good. But then now he destroys you, so.
Well, yeah, and the really funny thing about Shang Tsung, and I actually could not remember this. I thought people were pulling my leg, but if you go and read his ending from Mortal Kombat 2, Shang Tsung's always kind of had a comedic air to him that I think was maybe unintentional, because after Goro in Mortal Kombat 1, he really is pretty easy as long as he doesn't morph into Goro. But in Mortal Kombat 2, the ending is basically, and I'm very loosely paraphrasing here, Shang Tsung won and the earth was destroyed and everything was destroyed. Have a nice day. Like it says,
yes.
Have a nice day.
Yes.
And you're just like, wow. Shang Tsung just destroying all the things, and it was just really funny.
So Shang Tsung was in Mortal Kombat 2 as well?
Yes, but he was. So the story was, he told Shao Kahn, like, of course I was going to lose. I was super old. Make me young again, and I'll never lose. And then, of course, if you played as him, you're defecting from the Emperor. But yeah, you played Shang Tsung, and you could turn into everybody. That's why he was so awesome.
I forgot that he was in 2. I thought he was in 3. That's really cool. Okay.
Yeah,
young Shang Tsung is in 2. Okay, this is good. I'm learning.
Yeah, he's an old man in 1. Then in 2, he's a younger man, but he's still kind of like, I don't know. I feel like he still looks like someone's dad. Mm-hmm. And then in Mortal Kombat 3, he is full goth, long-haired ponytail, kind of ripped. It's definitely like each game he changes his look significantly.
That's awesome.
And yeah. The have a nice day line, that's actually in Raiden's ending in the first game. So they use the same joke.
That's right. So I guess that shows, even back then, like, you know, Ed Boon and John Tobias clearly had a sense of humor about this whole thing.
Oh, very much so, yeah.
So, speaking of humor, what about that hidden character who was added to later revisions?
Yes. Oh,
Mr. Reptile.
There was another ninja. Why not have 3 ninjas?
Why not? You know, palette swap. Memory is free.
Why not have the 3 ninjas from the movie The 3 Ninjas?
That's right.
Stu, those are children. We cannot kill children in the movie.
No, you can't kill children. Killing Sonya is
bad. That had Mr. Miyagi in it as well, didn't it? Man, everything's coming full circle. I always thought you should add Johnny from Cobra Kai into the next Mortal Kombat, but I don't think they'd let you pull his head off or anything. So,
anyway. Yeah, but you know Johnny would pull some heads off, though.
Oh, yeah, so. You know he would, yeah. And yet he'd somehow still find a way to make him likable.
Yeah. Yeah, because he'd start every round just waking up from a hangover or something.
Yeah, and he can only sweep. He only has sweeps.
He'd sweep the leg. That's it.
Yeah. Yeah, this is now a Cobra Kai podcast.
I'm here for it. No, Reptile was pretty cool. They wanted, you know, Ed and John wanted to do something secret. And I always wanted to play him as a kid because he had Sub-Zero's and Scorpion's moves, and he was twice as fast. But the cool thing about him was he was another one of those things like the fatalities where in early versions of the game, they did not have him drop down randomly before some rounds to offer hints how to find him. So after, even after Mortal Kombat was out for several months, you would have people claiming to have fought a green ninja and everyone else just thinking they were full of it because, of course, it's not a green ninja. We know everyone that's here and we believe in fatalities now, but this green ninja, that's a bridge too far. And then, you know, this, the circumstances to fight him. I mean, back in the arcade days, I don't know how anyone would figure this out without it being revealed in a magazine, which I found out that, you know, the game developers, they would, at certain intervals, they would give secrets to the press, because otherwise, how could you, like, you had to, there had to be certain silhouettes flying over the moon in the pit, and you had to get a double flawless and a fatality without blocking. So certain characters really couldn't fight Reptile because you had to hold block to their fatality.
Yeah.
It was just the most obscure, arcane set of circumstances in
history. Yeah, and it's funny, you know, in Mortal Kombat 2, you know, there were ways to fight hidden characters in that game too. And whenever I heard the rules, I was like, that can't be real. And then it was always real.
Yeah, yeah. One of them's like, only use low kicks or something, yes. Isn't it?
That's yeah, you have to win around only low kicks.
Yeah, ridiculous.
Which is harder than you would think.
I just love stuff like that. That's so cool.
It is. And I feel like that's something where modern Mortal Kombat games, I think NetherRealm is still struggling to figure out, like, how can we do something so secret that the internet hasn't, like, cracked the code in 24 hours.
In this era of data mining games, like, days after they come out as well, it's almost impossible. Like, that's something that they were really good at fostering on Mortal Kombat 1, 2, and 3, is that kind of community of, like, is this in the game, is this not? I mean, even like, NBA Jam had that from the same sort of house. But I think my favorite example is the Mortal Kombat 2 rumors that you could get the trees in the Living Forest to eat the opponents or something. And then they actually put that in Shaolin Monks in the PS2 game.
Yes.
Which was a really, really cool knob, I thought. But I know it's not MK1, but I wanted to mention it just in case.
Well, that's something. They actually put that in Mortal Kombat 9, which was, you know, a reboot of 1, 2, and 3. So yes. That was kind of cool, too. But this is something I found out, that starting with Mortal Kombat 1, there were certain players, especially these older kids who just had to prove their superiority. They would do a fatality, but you would ask them how to do it, and they wouldn't tell you. Or they would cover their hands while they move the joystick and press the buttons. And so, like, they had to be the coolest kid in the arcade because they had the fatalities. In fact, that was my first writing job. I was the first kid in my school to have a Mortal Kombat strategy guide. So people were asking me for the codes, and I was like, no, I have the code. I'm mortal. What are you doing? And eventually, I went to the computer lab. I wrote out all the special moves, all the fatalities. This was for Mortal Kombat 1. And I would sell the list to kids for 25 cents each. That was my first paid writing gig.
Nice.
So, yeah, pretty unscrupulous, but it was a living.
David, I know what you're talking about, and I always resented those kids because once I found out things, I would always tell anyone who asked. And it almost bit me in the ass at one point because I actually, you know, a few months after it was released in the spring of 93, I was on a trip to France. So you're in your neck of the woods, Stu. And I was in France and I was playing. Of course, I went to arcades in France. Why wouldn't I do that? And I was playing Mortal Kombat in France and I knew all the moves. So I was doing all the moves. And then kids in France would be like, hey, how'd you do that? But they would ask me in French. And I had to try to explain the moves in French, you know, like, even though I don't know any of the proper verbs to explain it, I was like, it's been 30 years, so I don't remember the French that I forgot back then. But
I believe it is lift fatality.
It was that easy. And then, of course, there was, it's almost like math. There was kind of a universal language where if you happen to have pencil and paper on you, you could just draw the arrows, like, back to forward to, you know, whatever the punches and kicks
were. Yeah, but in French, those were all reversed, I think, so it's a big deal.
Oh. You got to put the U in there. It's a U, you put extra consonants in every letter, yeah. Anyway, so, arcades, Reptile, maybe we should take a moment and talk about, Mortal Kombat, you can kill people. People can die. It's called a fatality. And it was pretty shocking, but it's also, I don't know, I would say it's kind of hard to, you know, it's so many years of hindsight, it's really hard to make a judgment call on this. I know the first time I saw it, I was definitely shocked and taken aback, but really, it is kind of goofy, isn't it?
Like, yeah, it is.
Kind of goofy?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like, it's two photographs of people, it's basically two animated GIFs. Two animated GIFs touch each other, and one falls down, and maybe one of them falls into two GIFs. You know, like, what's really the harm there?
I mean, I agree that there's no harm, but sort of expanding on what was said earlier, if I had not been aware that fatalities existed, had been playing that game, not seeing fatalities, and then suddenly someone busted one out and you got that whole do-do-do thing, you know, I would have probably crapped my pants. So, no. I mean, compared to the later ones when they get really silly and over the top and you start getting things like friendships and babalities and animalities and mercies and brutalities and all that sort of stuff, I think that the ones in Mortal Kombat do retain some impact simply because they're quite scarce. But, yeah, there's nothing on the level of the later ones at all, like when you're skinning people or eating people or anything like that.
No, it was really shocking. I mean, again, I saw this when I was 10, so I could joke now about my dad not letting me play it, but it was, like, that stuck with me. I was like, I just saw a guy rip out someone's heart, and it was, you know, for the time, those graphics were photorealistic, and I think it was interesting because it's obviously something you knew couldn't be done in real life, even if you couldn't articulate that. But it was definitely something that really stood out and kind of led to video game ratings. I mean, there were other games involved, like Night Trap, Stuart, I believe you mentioned that earlier. Mm. But even Night Trap, because of the FMV quality, like a lot of the violence and the rape scene, and that was more implied, which can be even worse in its own way than explicitly shown. But
I mean, the one thing I would say with that really is, not to get into sort of detail, obviously, but mm-hmm. take a look at something like Night Trap, which had a huge moral panic. And then if you look over at the PC and something like Phantasmagoria, which had no moral panic at all and is violent and hideous, I do think that there's a bit, maybe something of a double standard going on there, but I don't know. I mean, Mortal Kombat is just like, the fact that they took the blood out of the home port and then had it being able to put back in with a code almost feels kind of, I don't know if it's surreptitious, I don't know if they announced that or how that went down in general, but it feels like a little bit of a subterfuge. Like, look, it's okay, there's no blood, we took the blood out, see? Wink. You know? Unless you can access this particular flag screen and turn it back on again, which is dumb using this code, but don't do it.
So that's the funny thing. I wrote about this in the book because there is a lot of this that I didn't know. What I found out was that, so Sega at this time was losing to Nintendo. They were gaining a lot of ground with the Genesis and Mega Drive, but Nintendo was still in the lead, especially because, you know, in 1992, Capcom gave Nintendo the exclusive rights to the first home version of Street Fighter II. That was a big deal.
Yeah.
So Tom Kalinske of Sega of America was like, well, you know what? By default, we don't want blood in this, but I think let's do a cheat code because we know that's something Nintendo will not do. They will definitely not allow blood in their version through any means. And that was something that Acclaim said, okay, let's do that. And they actually made it part of the marketing where they quote unquote leaked it to the press in a certain issue because they didn't want people talking about the blood code right away. They wanted the talk to be about the censorship in the Nintendo version. And, you know, was it real? Was there really going to be blood? Were there going to be new fatalities that were watered down? And there were actually two blood codes. Stuart, earlier you mentioned the down, up, left, left, A, right, down, which is really funny because most people I talk to, they think of the ABACABB, the ABACAB code. Fewer people know about Dullard, even though Dullard was the one where not only you open up this whole menu where you could turn on blood, but you could also do other things like pick.
Yeah, the flags of. That's the one that I know just because that was the one that was in the. In the UK Sega magazines that I had when I was a kid, basically. It sticks out because you remember it because it's the word, you know, dollared. So, yeah, it sticks with you.
Yeah. And in fact, actually, so that was the first code that Paul Crothers ported the Sega Genesis version. I talked to him for another book a few years ago. And then he was told by, I think it was someone at Acclaim, because he was a contractor for Probe. So he turned his work into Probe. Probe gave it to Acclaim, and then it was this whole game of telephone. And Acclaim said, well, that's a little hard to do. We need another cheat code. But because you made this one 7 inputs, the other code should be easier, but also 7 inputs. And so Paul was like, oh, okay. Genesis, Phil Collins. I love that band. ABACAB, which was their album, Abacab. Yeah. But then he added one more B so that it was 7 7 inputs.
What's that extra B for? That's a typo.
Blood.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah, that's extra typo. B is for blood.
Yeah. But, you know, what happened there was, you know, the Sega Genesis version of Mortal Kombat outsold Nintendo's 5-1. And Nintendo actually, you know, was pretty upset about that, mostly because they were losing. In fact, that, you know, in December 93, a few months after the home versions came out, there was the court hearings, the Senate hearings, and it really kind of devolved into a slugfest between Sega's reps and Nintendo of America's reps. And the whole thing was Nintendo was basically pissed because they were starting to lose. This is when Sega was really overtaking them and more publishers were defecting. You know, they were getting out of their exclusivity contracts with Nintendo and going to Sega. And for Mortal Kombat 2, they said, all right, fine, leave blood in from the beginning. But the Sega Genesis version of MK2 still outsold the SNES version because it had the reputation from the first game of the blood code, even though the Super Nintendo version was a lot better, more true to the arcade. Yeah. But it was a whole thing there. And I actually think that was important. I've been talking a long time. I apologize, but it was
it's okay.
It, you know, it led to the ESRB, and everyone who was a part of it, even Acclaim, was like, well, we're really glad about the controversy because it's selling more games, so this is awesome. But we can agree that, like, ratings need to be a thing. We see no problem with that. It's good for parents to have some sort of guide. And in fact, the only reason, you know, I said earlier that my mom was fine with me playing. She was, but she even told me, like, look, if you throw one punch at school, I'm taking all this stuff away. You'll never see it again. And that was incentive enough. Besides being the nerdy kid with thick Coke bottle glasses to never throw a punch at school. I think it's a good thing because, you know, Mortal Kombat 2 came out just before the ESRB went into effect, but they still had the M rating on. And it's this whole other conversation of, like, that kind of made M for mature mean, like, oh, mature games equals, like, blood and guts and sex, where mature had a different – should have a different meaning. But it really – this was the point at which I think thanks to Mortal Kombat – the industry at large and the general public kind of started to acknowledge for the first time, oh, video games can be more than just toys, as Nintendo, who controlled the narrative up until then, kind of wanted us to perceive them. And so that's really culturally significant, I would say.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it must have given developers some kind of more sort of boldness to actually make games that were more sort of violent and gross, I suppose, now that they have an actual legal recourse to do so.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm trying to think what of examples, but I can't really think of that many other than stuff like Doom Troopers. It still didn't seem like, I guess maybe because even still they wouldn't necessarily sell huge numbers.
Well, the two interesting points to that. First of all, in my research, I actually, this is sort of like a Mandela effect, but I remember Doom being as wrapped up in this as Night Trap and Mortal Kombat, but Doom actually did not get its comeuppance in the mainstream media for another 6 years until Columbine, because Doom as a PC game, like, it's hugely significant, but back then PCs were so expensive that most people didn't really play Doom until a lot of the console ports came out in the mid-90s. Mm. And they were so kind of watered down technically anyway that, like, by that time we'd all been playing Mortal Kombat for years, it wasn't as big of a deal. But the second thing is, Nintendo would occasionally try to assert its family-friendly image. I remember Resident Evil 2 coming to the N64 was a big deal, and you could make the blood blue or green, but what was hilarious was, because this game used static backgrounds, the blood in bodies that was already drawn was always red. So even if you chose for the zombies you were killing to bleed blue, you still have these, like, gory, mutilated corpses in every screen. So it didn't really change much.
There are some strange anomalies. I think in N64 again, like, they censored the version of Duke Nukem in 3D that was on the 64. They took out, like, the more, shall we say, risque imagery.
Yes, yes.
But they made the game exponentially more violent. There was a lot more blood and guts, a lot more jibs.
I love that version.
Which is, it's an incredible version. And stay tuned for a Duke Nukem episode later this year. Sorry. Going back a bit, sorry, to Mortal Kombat, I want to say about the SNES version, I think it's a shame that it ended up that way, because honestly, taking aside the lack of blood and the lack of fatalities, it's a pretty good version.
Yes.
Like, I really love the music in that version, and it really does feel smooth to play. And I always think it's weird. Now, if this has actually happened, please write in that no one's done a sort of restoration ROM hack or something. I mean, yeah, restoring the fatalities might well be a tall order. I assume someone's put the blood back in, because that doesn't seem like it would be that difficult to do.
So here's why that's never happened, actually, because I looked into this. I'm writing a companion book to this Long Live Mortal Kombat book, where I talked to a team of ROM hackers based in Brazil who did a more arcade perfect version of the Sega Genesis version. And I said, you know, why isn't it? I mean, I know that obviously the Genesis version was more popular in the first place because of the blood code being a thing, but why hasn't anyone gone back to the SNES version? And he said, well, the main reason is, in the Genesis version, we had stuff to work with. Sprites like the, you know, the decapitated heads with the spinal cords attached, they were in the code in the first place in the Genesis version. They were just locked behind cheats. That's not in the Super Nintendo version. In fact, another thing they did, not only did they change, I write about this in the book as well, but not only did they change the blood to gray sweat, I've never seen sweat fly off that way, but it is what it is. They also, Nintendo said, oh, you can't have it splatter on the ground. So if you remember from the SNES version, the sweat flies into the air and then disappears. It does not splatter on the ground. And so to do a ROM hack of the SNES version, it's a lot of ROM hackers, they will learn assembly, which is a huge achievement as someone with a programming background. Yeah. But to go in and add things that were not there is above and beyond what most ROM hackers are capable of. Yeah.
I suppose, in a way, though, I suppose I am still surprised simply because it seems like such an obvious big deal, if that makes sense. Like, look, we finally made the SNES version of Mortal Kombat that you always wanted. But no, it is obviously, when you haven't got the raw materials to work with and you're essentially having to create content from scratch, that does obviously make it a much bigger sort of wall.
Yeah.
But yeah, it does surprise me a little bit that it hasn't really happened still after all this time.
It does surprise me as well, and I actually want to step further. There's a ROM hack again for the Genesis version of Ultimate MK3 called Ultimate Mortal Kombat Trilogy, and this person, I don't even know if the ROM is so big that I don't know if it could have been committed to a Genesis cartridge, but it adds in all the characters from Mortal Kombat 1 and 2, whereas only a few were in the official trilogy. Again, I said, well, why for the Genesis version? Why not the SNES version? Well, it's because in certain countries, international countries, Nintendo hardware arrived after the Genesis version. So the Genesis version of these games, in fact, in like Brazil and a lot of South American countries, Ultimate MK3 for Mega Drive / Genesis is still played widely today.
Wow.
But the Super Nintendo version was just so late to the game that people just ignored it. It was also very expensive. That's why you had to pirate a lot of this stuff. Yeah. The hardware especially was so expensive. So you'd get these knockoff consoles, and then you would go to vendors on the street selling cartridges with burned ROM. And it was just Genesis Mortal Kombat was pervasive in a way that no SNES version ever really was.
Well, David, you also, in your book, you talk about Mortal Kombat Nitro, which seems appropriate to this conversation. Can you – that was something I never heard of until I read your book.
Yeah, it was on Turner, and it had the NWO in it. Sorry, that's rubbish. Carry on.
Mortal Kombat Monday Nitro. So this was there was a guy I talked to from Acclaim who was kind of a lead product analyst named James Fink, and he was one of the self-professed arcade rats who would go to arcades, and he loved to hustle, loved to compete. He would play with one hand. In fact, he even sent me a photograph someone took of him playing, I think it was Mortal Kombat 2 with one hand. That'll be in the book. But at Acclaim, there was another big problem with the SNES version, and I wrote about this a few years ago. Originally at Sculptured Software, one programmer, I'll leave him nameless, but he said, oh, I can do this whole thing. Months passed, he said, I can't do any of this, and he went on to another project. And so three other programmers had to jump in. This ended up where not only was the game censored, which was all Nintendo's call, but if you go back and play that version, even on emulators, the input is terrible. There was a sync where if you just tap a button, it does not register. You have to press them very, very hard. And even then, the controls are still very unresponsive. So James Fink at Acclaim was like, you know, I know that Mortal Kombat 2 is an arcade. It's obviously going to be our next project. But what if we pull like a Street Fighter 2 to Street Fighter 2 Turbo for SNES, where we release this game, let's call it Mortal Kombat Nitro, where it has all the blood, because Nintendo at this point had been kind of just shellacked at retail. We'll add all the blood, we'll have the original fatalities, but we'll also add more fatalities. We'll do like an Allegiant sort of system where you can get light or dark versions of characters with unique fatalities. He sent me his design document, and it's something that Acclaim and Sculptured considered. And they even took a lot of the fatalities that were neutered in the SNES version and added to them. For example, Johnny Cage, instead of uppercutting someone's head off, he just kicks them to the chest and they scream and then fall down. Well, in this version, and he streamed it for me because he has a prototype. There are only two. James has one and Ed Boon has the other one. In this one, Johnny Cage does that same kick, but a whole bunch of blood and guts fly out of their back as if he kicked them so hard that everything just flew out and scatter on the screen and then they fall down. I'm like, well, that's awesome. I love that fatality. But Acclaim said, you know what? Mortal Kombat 2 is in arcades. It's doing really well. That's, you know, we have a contract. We get first rights of refusal on Midway's games. We're definitely doing MK2. We don't really want to give people a reason to rebuy Mortal Kombat 1. And so it never got anywhere. But it was in a prototype. You know, James showed it to me. And in fact, he said it was unfinished and it was so buggy that by the third fight, the characters just kind of float off the screen and you have to reset. But, I totally would have snatched that up as a kid because I was a Nintendo kid. I was very envious of a friend of mine who had the Sega Genesis version of Mortal Kombat because even though my graphics and music were better, he had the blood code and I totally would have bought this Mortal Kombat Nitro thing with my paper route that paid $40 a month. But it would have happened.
We've been chatting for a while now, and I think we should probably move towards the end. And I think it's important to ask the question, so how does someone today play the original Mortal Kombat? And I don't think there's a really good answer, right? Aside from piracy? I mean...
Yeah, I mean, there have been a lot of re-releases, but I can't think of a contemporary one.
Yeah, I looked things up. There was a 2011 Mortal Kombat Arcade Collection, with a K, of course, that was out on PS3, 360, and Steam, but it seems to have been delisted. I couldn't find it on Steam.
And it really, really sucked.
It was not good.
It was not
good. In my opinion, it was not good, no.
Right.
No. If memory serves, I might be mistaking this for another port, but if you paused the game and unpaused, there was actually lag, so you would just get destroyed. Like, not that you should be doing that anyway, but it would be like, once you unpause, you'd have about a second before you could move again, but the computer did not have that.
Yeah.
It was not good.
It was a very odd port. In fact, the Steam version, if you have it in your library, you can still install it.
Yeah, but I think I do still have it, yeah.
Well, so the problem there is I went to do that a year or so ago, but it was one of the games that was tied to Games for Windows Live, but never untethered, so you can't even play it now.
Oh, man. Yeah. That sucks.
Yeah.
Well, I know GOG.com has a software called Mortal Kombat 1 plus 2 plus 3, and the reviews for that are up and down. I think some of the versions are good, but some of them are not good. Like, I think 1 is pretty good, but 2 is bad.
Visually, they're very impressively close to the arcade if memory serves, but I think setting them up with a joypad or a stick is going to be pretty difficult, and you do not want to play a fighting game on the keyboard unless it's called 1 plus 4. So, no, I wouldn't recommend those ports either. I mean, they used to include these games with the contemporary ones, but they seem to have stopped doing it now. Now, they were going to do a fully remade one, weren't they, with new digitized footage, like proper HD, but then that got canned.
Yes.
I'm sure I remember that was in progress.
That was, in fact.
It was going to be the first three games, wasn't it? It was going to be a remake of 1, 2, and 3 with full, like... reshot, redigitized full HD.
And new actors. Because by that point, like Dan Pacino and a few of the others had fallen out with Midway, so they were kind of persona non grata. In fact, I have a full chapter in Long Live Mortal Kombat on that game. Other Ocean was going to do that, now Digital Eclipse. And it was they couldn't get Ed Boon to sign off on it. He didn't like a lot of the changes, and they actually agreed with him. They said the problem with what they were doing was because these were supposed to be remasters, they would have their new actors not just doing the moves, but doing the moves while watching footage of the old actors and trying to recreate them exactly. But there were like weird height differences that would mean certain moves would or would not match up. And it was just, it was kind of a whole thing. It was harder than you'd think.
I wish that Digital Eclipse would just do a Mortal Kombat collection though, because they do such good work.
I do too, especially did that excellent Street Fighter one from a few years ago. I'm hoping that because this is the 30th anniversary, I feel like NetherRealm has to have a re-release somewhere. I mean, everyone's kind of expecting them to announce Mortal Kombat 12, but you know, not every game franchise makes it to 30. So I feel like this is a situation where they should say like, hey, we've got something new coming out, but also here's a modern collection, because I feel like those, like the original arcade games, seem like they would be tailor-made for Switch, like arcade perfect handheld versions of those games Switch.
I'd love that. Yeah. I mean, the last one was the DS port of Ultimate Mortal Kombat 3, which was staggeringly good considering.
It was so good.
And I just want them to do, and I think they included puzzle combat with that as well. But I just want them to do these games justice, even if it's just Digital Eclipse or someone just porting the original arcade versions, and you know what, throw in the home versions as well, because that's what they do.
And especially
just do one. All I want is 1, 2, 3 and Ultimate. I don't need anything other than that. I mean, anything other than that would be lovely, but I don't need it.
it
would just be gravy, basically.
Well, just going back to what Diamond said, right? Like, there are on no contemporary system can you play those games, and that seems like it's kind of criminally overlooked, the fact that these games are of such significance, but you cannot play them anywhere, whereas you can play Street Fighter and a bajillion other arcade games on almost any platform you can throw a stone at. It's a really weird, sad thing.
It's weird to think that soon I'm going to be able to play Turtles in Time and Turtles Tournament Fighters on the PS5, but not Mortal Kombat.
Yeah, and actually that's so that arcade collection, or the Turtles collection, going back to what you said, Stuart, where they have not only the arcade versions, but every home version of every Turtles game. I would love to see the same thing. If we only get arcade ports of Mortal Kombat games, fine. But if you also throw in all the home versions, even this, like the terrible Game Boy version of the first game, which was actually like my first version, because the Game Boy is the only thing I had when, you know, Mortal Monday happened.
Get the old Master System and Game Gear versions on there too.
Yeah. Like just throw them all on there. Like, it would be really, really cool artifacts with design.
If anyone from Digital Eclipse is listening to this, and statistically you probably are.
Yes.
You might want to get on with that, okay? Like, come on, that's free money. Like, let's go. Mortal Kombat 1, 2, 3, Ultimate, and if you feel like it, put Mythologies and Trilogy on there. I would like them.
I'm also one of those weirdos. I love Mortal Kombat 4, and that game has not been acknowledged for decades. I feel like if you're going to do, like, they released that arcade collection. I just remember thinking, like, this isn't really, like, it is a collection, but it's not the collection unless you're leaving because you're leaving off one of the arcade games. It was always kind of a weird thing for me.
Yeah, that is a good point. They should throw it. They should put that into. Why not?
Yeah.
Although you can buy MK4 on GOG, can't you, as well?
You can, the PC version, which is excellent, because I had that one back in the day. The graphics are great. You have the enhanced endings with the same voice acting, which makes them very, very fun.
This is not a brutality. This is a fatality.
Fatality. They had much better gamepad support. Even I think back in the 90s, I played those with a Microsoft Sidewinder, which was like
the
great gamepad before Xbox compatibility happened. So,
and then you use one now and you look at that D-pad and just immediately vomit, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But back then it was great.
Yes, it was. It was really your best option.
It really was.
We could go on about the PC versions for some time, but I would love to see just these games re-released on a contemporary platform. I think they should be, honestly.
I would just like to say that I do have two preteen children. One of them's going to be a teenager pretty soon, let's be honest. But they're preteen for now. And I feel like I would be okay with them playing old Mortal Kombat. I feel like that would not strike them as too gross or too weird. I think they would look at it as they would laugh and enjoy it. But I would not want them to play like normal, like modern Mortal Kombat, because that to me just, I don't know. Here's my theory. My theory is that if you play the old games, you have pictures of people, and then they hit each other, and then they turn into obvious not people anymore. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you play the modern games, everything is rendered so realistic, it looks like you're actually chopping someone in half. And to me, that's just too gross. That's well, my theory.
And the other problem there is, I mean, I kind of feel the same way. Like, I thought Mortal Kombat 3's fatalities went a little too far in the cartoonist direction. But
yes.
A lot of the modern fatalities are actually upsetting to the point where you had that story about NetherRealm developers saying, I kind of have PTSD because I've worked so long on these fatalities and I'm just very disturbed by the whole thing. Like, there's just something there that is kind of disgusting about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, they were having them look at real, like, footage of, like, graphic violence and stuff, weren't they, to get the, yes. It's not really on. Shame on you, NetherRealm. That puts up the question I wanted to ask at the end of this, because there was something I really wanted to make sure that got covered, but now I feel like it might come across as a bit too ghoulish.
What is that?
I was going to ask what you guys' favorite fatality is across the entire franchise.
Honestly, I can still, it's still Sub-Zero's original head rip from the first game. Yeah. Just because it was not the first fatality I saw, but it's the first one. I feel like the funny thing is, like, that's the one you would see on, like, newscasts. This new video game, so violent, Mortal Kombat, and they show Sub-Zero ripping a head off. And I'm like, that's kind of the,
some
like,
may
the
be
fatality.
Disturbed by the following scenes.
That's right. Yeah, that's my favorite across the whole series.
Well, Stu, I can tell you that I wrote a short story when I was 14, and it involved me playing Mortal Kombat, and I discussed the fatality, and that was the fatality I picked. But as far as for me as a player, my favorite was always the Kintaro transformation in Mortal Kombat 2.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Because...
Then you have to hold high punch for like 20 seconds to do that.
Yeah. 30. 30. Yeah.
It was, 30 seconds, blame me.
It was difficult to pull off, so it was kind of like a handicap. But whenever I did it, there was always someone watching me in the arcade who had never seen it before. It was always a surprise. Mm. And when they saw it, it was just the reaction. It was like a rap video. Everyone was like, oh, you know, just yes. It was an electric atmosphere. So that was always my favorite.
It is a real flex to beat someone without using a high punch, I guess, because you basically would have to hold it for almost the entire match, wouldn't you?
Yes.
Yeah.
My way of doing it is I would basically, if you hold it before the match starts, then it's active.
Oh, wow.
So that's how I did it. Same with Raiden's. Raiden has another, it's a different fatality. We have to hold, I think, high punch for like 10 seconds exactly. But if you're holding it before the fatality time starts, it's counting. So nice. When late in the match, I would start holding it down. But even that was the timing of that one was tricky, where the Kintaro one, I don't know. I got it every time. No question.
That's awesome. I don't think I've even seen that one. I just know it exists. I guess I got to give away. I mean, I couldn't. It's really hard for me to pick between two, so I'm just going to say both of them. Sorry. And I know it's from one of the later games, but there's an incredibly revolting Johnny Cage fatality where he, like, literally pulls someone's entire torso apart so he can lean through it and go, oh. Here's Johnny.
Yeah.
And it's so utterly disgusting that I have to give it some props. But honestly, my all-time favorite is Mortal Kombat 3 Sindel when she just screams at you so loud all your skin comes off. Like, that's just immortal to me. Like, that's hilarious. That's like some, I don't know, that's like Tex Avery style, like, cartoon violence to me. And it is disgusting. She's just this dripping mass of, like, muscles.
Yeah, I love that one, too.
Yeah, it's very, very funny. Yeah. I could give a shout-out to all kinds of fatalities, but that's probably my favorite. Just scream at you so loud or your skin flies off, of course.
So I think we're entering the end game here. So, David, you keep mentioning Long Live Mortal Kombat, which sounds like a book. Can people buy this book in store shelves now, or?
People will be able to buy it on store shelves this fall. But right now, it is a Kickstarter, and you can go back it. There are a couple editions. One is actually appropriately called Ultimate Long Live Mortal Kombat, which is a deluxe size coffee table style book with a lot of full color photos. I got hundreds of photos from fans, and that's kind of the emphasis. So this is the first book in a trilogy, focuses on the arcade era, the home games, but also the fan culture, where I learned that, you know, despite all the outcry around Mortal Kombat back then and now, although, you know, to a lesser degree, I talked to so many people and all of them across the board have been positively influenced by this terrible, corruptible game. And it was pretty cool to share those stories, to learn things about how Mortal Kombat was played in other countries, and also to talk to the developers to kind of go behind the doors of Midway Williams, whoever they are, and you know, get into the nitty-gritty of code and stuff there.
Great. So, yeah, when this episode goes live, the Kickstarter should already be live. So by all means, please check that out. I'm sure we'll have a link to it in the show notes. And David, as long as we're promoting stuff, is there anything else you'd like to share with us? Maybe another book, or do you use Twitter or TikTok, or what's your handles there?
I do use clocks, but on Twitter, my handle is at David L. Craddock, and I'm also directing my first film. I'm with a company that is producing FPS, first-person shooter. We've interviewed John Romero, John Carmack, Cliff Bleszinski. I mean, you name it, and they're in this. Second round of funding will take place in May, and it'll be out in February 2023.
Cool.
Great. Thank you.
Is it based on the Season 7 X-Files episode, also named First Person Shooter?
It is, but, you know, let's not get too deep into spoilers, you know?
Okay, sorry.
Stu, that gives something to look forward to. I am watching X-Files. I think I mentioned that in a previous recording, but that's...
Oh, it's awful. It's such a bad episode. Okay. It's the worst episode of the entire series.
All right. I'm still excited. Stu, so when you're not talking about X-Files, what sort of things do you do on the internet?
I'm always talking about X-Files, baby. You can find me at Stupacabra on Twitter. I am another host of Retronauts. I tend to lean into doing more sort of British-y things for some reason. I can't even fathom what it is. I also write for Nintendo, Life Push Square, occasionally Retro Gamer Magazine. I have something coming up in Sega Powered Magazine and a lock-on journal from Lost in Cold. And I've written a book that's probably out this year at some point, and I'll give more details when that becomes a thing. I do loads of things, all sorts of things. Just look me up on Twitter and you'll find my link tree there with all the links to all my amazingly great things that I do.
Wonderful. Well, to everyone else listening, thank you very much. This is Retronauts. Thank you for listening. We are a fan-supported show. You can go to patreon.com/retronauts to support this program. $3. That's $3. That gets you episodes 1 week early and a slightly higher audio quality. However, for $5, just $2 more than $3. That's a small amount.
Such a small amount.
Yes. For that money, you get 2 bonus episodes every month, and you get a weekly column/mini podcast written by me, recorded by me, narrated by me. We also have Discord access, $5. I think it's a wonderful deal, and I think you should all consider doing it. Also, you can, I'm on the internet too. I'm not just hosting Retronauts here. I have my own bag, you know? You can look me up on Twitter and Twitch as Fight Club. F-E-I-T, my last name, C-L-U-B, the English word. So, before we wrap up, everybody, real quick, if you are a Chinese ninja, what color is your outfit? David?
Orange.
Orange. Stu?
Chinese ninja with the hot so cold. I don't wear one, I just go au naturel.
So,
the element of surprise.
You're going the opposite way. The most conspicuous ninja possible.
Yeah. And also, it's very cold, so nobody make any comments. Plus, I have ice powers, which exacerbates the problem.
Ah. I'm going to go with, what's the name? Vermilion.
Nice.
Vermilion Chinese ninja. Anyway, that's it. I'm sure we'll go out with the appropriate music, so everyone just get your techno going on. Good night!